Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Putting drastic downsizing plans into effect outlined to Congress this month, which included eliminating more than 30,000 jobs. Shutting factories. Wait a minute. I thought this was supposed to stop all of this.
Yeah, and the shutdown is longer than ever.
Yeah, right for the holiday shutdown.
Right.
Right. They're going to shed dealerships.
Yeah.
Yeah. And determine the future of its Saab, Saturn, and Pontiac brands. Mm. They still make Pontiacs?
I guess so.
Do we have any Pontiac sponsors? I haven't heard any. Chrysler has shut down all of its 30 U.S. plants for a month, and it cites continued lack of consumer credit. In other words, that we can't get it. But isn't that what we're putting up these hundreds of billions of dollars to these financial institutions to do?
Yeah, you would think. No. It turns out a lot of that money is going to the CEOs.
Yes. And let's see, as outlook dims, Obama expands recovery plans. Faced with worsening forecasts for the economy, President-elect Barack Obama says here in the Times, New York Times, is expanding his economic recovery plan and will seek to create or save 3 million jobs in the next 2 years, up from a goal of 2.5 million jobs. Thing is, though, they expect to lose 4 million. Obama's more ambitious goal would not fully offset as many as 4 million jobs. The job loss would be double the total this year and could push the nation's unemployment rate past 9% if nothing is done. It's already past 9% officially in Michigan, and I'm sure much, much more. Now, they're still, they, being the Republicans particularly, are still after the UAW, because what they want is to destroy the United Auto Workers. Partly, it goes back to what we were talking about, the global warming, because it's the combination of politics, greed, and psychopathology. Yeah, they really despise anybody that has that can collectively gain strength by joining together to better their lives.
William just sent us an email about the bailouts and said, why did all three go to D.C. in their corporate jets to get them? Now suddenly Ford does not need it now, and GM has opened another plant in China.
Well, I don't know. Mm. I don't know what to say. Here, UAW's sacrifices look to some like surrender. This is from the Washington Post. For decades after its founding in 1935, the UAW stood as a powerful model for the American labor movement, an influential organization that historians credit with uplifting living standards for all working Americans.
Hey, now, what a concept.
What a concept. And you got to remember, these conservatives want to destroy the organized power of this. And so I know that we function in this country so much on what I've always called the politics of resentment, that people are saying, good, they make too much money anyways. I'm not talking about rich people. I'm talking about those of you who make less than UAW workers that are thinking, good, they're going to be right down with me making $9 an hour instead of their $28 an hour. Rather than thinking, hey, they set the standard. In fact, if it wasn't for them making $28 an hour, you'd probably be making $4 an hour.
True.
Because it's the union movement in the 1930s that set the basis for the minimum wage laws, among other things. But let's see.
Even though it's still not enough.
Yeah. The announcement of the federal loan deal on Friday, the union found itself being forced into concessions that some described as tantamount to surrender. The $17.4 billion federal loan agreement keeps the industry alive, but the terms of the loan also insist that the wages and benefit for union workers be lowered to, quote, competitive,
meaning lowered to competitive minimum wage?
The average of non-union workers, specifically those at U.S. plants of Nissan, Toyota, and Honda. Why? Why? I mean, it's not that much different. In fact, this $14 an hour that Gettelfinger gave away in the last contracts, negotiations last year, puts it way below that. And here, in fact, let me see. I was going to say,
don't they make pretty good money down there at the Tennessee plants?
Well, they do, because one of the ways that they were able to keep the unions out was to say, hey, we're going to pay you almost the same thing, and you don't have to belong to a union, you don't have to pay dues, and we're going to give you the same, almost the same health care benefits, almost the same wage. And there's a whole anti-union history there. Again, it's sort of weird Southern psychopathology. Among workers, though, I mean, they're just nuts. Although, but it look, you know, if they look at this and they say, well, wait a minute. These guys can't protect their own wages, and they are in a union. Why should I belong to it? And that's what they're trying to that's the conservative strategy.
They're just trying to break it down to nothing.
Yeah, they are. And so it's partly because they want to destroy the struggle of 70 years of getting industrial workers into the middle class, but also the UAW, in many ways, and the rest of the unions, elected Barack Obama. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars. They sent tens of thousands of workers all around the country. I know lots of UAW people that spent a good 3 weeks before the election in Ohio, for instance, setting up, I was saying last week that the Obama campaign had an office in all, I think it's something like 82 counties in Ohio.
That was amazing.
And the last election for Kerry, they had seven. So, but here, in his testimony before Congress, Gettelfinger said that the 2007 UAW contract slashed, and that was, these are his words, slashed wages for new hires by 50%, that's down to $14 an hour. Furthermore, new hires will not be covered by the traditional retiree health care and defined benefit pension plans. This is Gettelfinger saying this. The 2007 contract gave up nearly $10 billion in wages and benefits, in addition to giving up $30 billion in retiree medical benefits. So the UAW has already given up $40 billion in potential, costs for the auto companies. They should not give up a thing. They shouldn't give up a penny. They should say, you want class war? Come and get it. Bring it on. I mean, because now is the time to draw a line in the sand for the average working person, because what the hell did any of us do? There's not a one of you listening that's responsible for this mess. And why should you or me or our families or our neighbors be paying the cost?
I think there's probably a lot of people listening tonight who will agree with you on that Peter.
I hope so. I mean, I'm not even sure, though. I'm not sure you're right. I'm sure, you know, the people saying, wow, it's those union janitors.
Well, there's always going to be that group, right?
The rich.
Yeah, I remember the people who were talking about the union janitors.
The rich elite. These are the ones that got us into here. This is a pretty interesting story. This was on the business page of the, actually it was on the front page, now that I think of it, of today's New York Times. It says, White House philosophy stoked mortgage bonfire. In other words, their philosophy was responsible for this mortgage mess that we're in. And Bush, they show a picture of Bush, I think you might have just got the text, but here's the photograph. He's standing in front of one of these huge signs that they always manage to erect, saying, a home of your own. This was June 2000. Bush spoke in Atlanta to unveil a plan to increase minority homeownership, right? And, of course, at the same time, there was absolutely no regulation that meant anything.
Yeah. All it did was hurt so many people.
Fantastic fortunes being made with no regulation. And this reminded me, this a home of your own sign with Bush smiling, of another sign that he stood in front of. It was called Mission Accomplished.
Oh, yeah. Well, he regrets that, Peter. He regrets saying that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he does.
Give us a break. Here. Did I tell you about the group I joined?
No, go ahead. What?
It's on Facebook, you join these groups. I can't believe I'm so into this, but I am. I must admit. And it's Throw a Million Shoes at George W. Bush.
If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, yeah. WERBE.com, there's a game you can play. You can throw shoes at them.
Well, and I don't know if we should get into it now, but things are good for the makers of these types of shoes.
Yeah. You're getting more ADD than I
am. I know. Let's go back. Talk about it later.
So we're talking about this housing crisis. Well, let me tell you about this this article. In fact, let me read a couple paragraphs. The global financial system was teetering on the edge of collapse when President Bush and his economics team huddled, and it said, in the words of one participant, it scared the hell out of everybody. It was September 18th. Lehman Brothers had just gone belly up, overwhelmed by toxic mortgages. Bank of America had swaddled Merrill Lynch in a hastily arranged sale. 2 days earlier, Mr. Bush had agreed to pump $85 billion into the failing insurance giant American International Group. The president listened as Ben S. Bernanke, chair of the Federal Reserve, laid out the latest terrifying news. The credit markets, gripped by panic, had frozen overnight, and banks were refusing to lend money. Then his Treasury Secretary, Henry M. Paulson Jr., told him that to stave off disaster, he would have to sign off on the biggest government bailout in history. Mr. Bush, according to several people in the room, paused for a single stunned moment to take it all in. He wondered aloud, how did we get here? Call a truck.
It's a real head shaker.
Yeah, it is. And the
from beginning to end.
And the Times says, let's see here. From his earliest days in office, Mr. Bush paired his belief that Americans do best when they own their own homes with his conviction that markets do best when let alone. Well, I think when markets are left alone, that probably the best example of what happens is this Bernie Madoff. You know, the guy, the $50 billion Ponzi scheme guy.
Yeah.
I mean, why would people invest in somebody whose last name is Madoff? Like, make off with the money.
It's a good point.
I don't get it. I mean, this again, this is not...
He's more of a jagoff, yeah, in my opinion.
Well, he, you know, he is actually a liberal Democrat.
Okay, he gets points for that.
Yeah, he took a lot of this scammed money and donated to charities.
For real?
Yeah, he was the respected...
He's psychotic.
Well, how he could, $50 billion gone, it says in the Detroit Free Press today, investigators said that only $200 million to $300 million of Madoff's investors' money is left. Where the rest went is a mystery.
Yeah.
So.
It didn't all go to charity.
So again, there's two economies. The one economy is the one that almost all of us are involved in right now, if we're lucky. That is, we work, we get paid, we buy. We save if we can. We buy a house if we can. We buy a car.
We buy less.
Yeah, or we buy less. But that's what we do. It's real easy. And one of the things that we do when we go to work every day is we create value. We create wealth. In other words, if we're working on a, you know, if we're an industrial worker, if we're a service worker, we create something tangible. These people, and the reason they got themselves into this jam of $50 billion, sorry, let's not expand it too much, $50 billion Ponzi scheme, where the Ponzi scheme is this clear?
Explain that.
Okay, I give you $100, right? And you say you're going to give me 10% back on the money. But you're not doing anything. You take the $100 and you take $5 for yourself, right? And then you get Meltdown, right? If he's listening, one of our DJs here, to invest another $100 and you give me $10 interest on it. And but you got to keep getting, you know, then you get Arthur Pennell, and then you get Ann Carlini, and then you get Mike in the Morning. So everybody keeps giving you money. You take some out for yourself.
And you give a little back.
A little back, and the rest is, yeah. And so
he showed all these books, and he would send statements, right, official statements.
So it's this huge pyramid scheme, but they always collapse at some point. But this has been going on forever. And some of the wealthiest people, there are like wealthy people that I have gone from being worth, say, $50 million
to having nothing.
Zero.
What's happening with this guy?
They're tough on him. He has to.
Oh, no.
He is confined to his $18 million penthouse.
Oh, how is he going to
between
go
6 p.m.
on
and 6 a.m.?
Oh, really?
And he's got to wear a tether.
Oh, poor baby.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I am. No, I don't believe in that either.
So the two economies, the first one is pretty obvious. We're all involved in it all the time. Or even WRIF here. We sell ads. You know, people pay for ads here. We play them on the air.
Yeah.
You know, it brings in revenue. Jalene and I get paid. You know, all that. But these other people are making money out of money, forgetting. I mean, it's really all a big Ponzi scheme. I mean, the whole stock market.
And you're not even talking about this guy.
No, yeah.
Right.
The whole, I mean, he's at like the ragged edge, the illegal edge. The legal edge of it still is people that are making money out of money. They're all of this speculation. So capitalism now is not about commodity production and sales. It is about speculation. It is this big, enormous crapshoot. And who gets punished all the time is the average person, the person that has that has a pretty narrow view of the world. And you know what that narrow view is? It's called family, neighborhood, enjoyment, mm-hmm. children. I guess that's part of the community, in church maybe, you know, stuff like that. And usually he or she has some confidence that the rich people in the $3,000 suits and wearing these $35,000 watches that you see advertised in almost on every full page ad for one watch all over the New York Times like today, that they're not going to screw everything up. But they screwed everything up. I'm sorry to put it in these terms, dear people, but if it becomes unscrewed up, which I don't have 100% confidence that we're going to get out of this. We may. I hope so. We will, but it's going to be a lot of people hurt. And some of those rich people are going to be hurt. Some of those upper middle class people are going to be hurt. But the people that are really taking the hits are the people that have done the least, that have worked the hardest, that have gotten, even in the best of times, rewarded the least for the worst, and oftentimes for the worst jobs in society. And people are begrudging a man or woman who spends 30 years in an auto plant with all that noise, all that toxic crap, all the hours of, you know, getting up early or in the middle of the night.
It's hard work.
Yeah. Oh, one final thing, too, about, and then it's a phone-in talk show, isn't it?
yes, it is.
This is a pretty thin section of the Detroit Free Press. It's a notice of delinquent tax parcels subject to foreclosure, February 11, 2009. It's published by the Oakland County Treasurer. It's a supplement to the Detroit News and Detroit Free Press today. And they have to publish this. This is 28
that
pages.
That is unbelievable.
28 pages.
I didn't even see that.
28 pages of listing, and each listing is, what, an inch?
Of foreclosed houses.
Yeah, I mean, on a page, it takes up a single inch.
So
there's thousands
sad.
In here. And you know what? This is thin compared to Wayne County, where...
Oakland County?
This is just Oakland County.
Oh, no.
Wayne County is three times the size. So why is the average person getting punished? Where's the pitchfork moment? When are the peasants going to come out? You and me and the rest of us. When are we going to come out of our thatched roof little modest homes into the public square with our pitchforks and demand, well, maybe not even demand, because then we're still asking the rulers, please treat us better. Please, sir, don't destroy everything so quickly. You got to do better than that. All right, Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G. Your new Apple iPhone 3G connects you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, we're going to get you on
the road. Log on and listen worldwide at WRIF.com. The Riff.
ABS, traction and stability control, sway and roll equalizers, sweet enhancements to have. Because winter in Michigan can turn road conditions treacherous in a matter of minutes. I know, because another driver lost control on an icy patch and whacked my car. My leg got jacked up, and I couldn't work. That's when I called John Wallace of Financial Law Group.
This is attorney John Wallace from the Financial Law Group. If you've been injured in a car accident and it's affected your professional and personal life, or feel your insurance company is rushing you to settle, give me a call. I'll work on your behalf to resolve your legal issues in the simplest, most cost-effective way possible. If you need legal representation, call me.
If you have an accident, John is the first call you should make. Now listen up and add his number to your cell.
The Financial Law Group, 586-6900. 593-2000. Evening and weekend appointments available. Put the right people to work for you. Call 586-693-2000. The Financial Law Group, PC. Using the law to protect your financial future. 586-693-2000.
What's a WALU?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
But what is a WALU?
Your kid will love it.
So what is a WALU?
WALU is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. So, you know, you can show off your little leaguer just like the pros. It looks great in the bedroom, basement, garage, or anywhere you want to decorate. And it's not just for kids. Get a WALU of your motorcycle or your sports car or boat. For anything you want to show off, it's a WALU. So check it out now at www.wal-theletteru.com. That's wal-theletteru.com. WALU, the perfect gift.
What's a WALU?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
But what is a WALU?
Your kid will love it.
So what is a WALU?
All right, we've been over this before, but it does bear repeating. A WALU is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. Imagine the possibilities. Whatever you have that you want to show off, it's a WALU. Look for the WALU ad on WRIF.com.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help get you out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Does your furnace need repair? Your house need cleaning? Or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen? Big or small, whatever your home improvement need, now it's easy to find the right home pro for your project. Log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to pre-screen remodelers, maids, handymen, roofers, and many other home contractors. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic has a network of licensed and insured contractors in hundreds of home improvement categories. If you need a painter, electrician, plumber, or any other home service, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free. And it's the source to find neighbor-recommended contractors in your area. Now you can hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's quick, it's free, and there's no obligation. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. Jolene Jordan is with me. And I want to go to our phones at 313-298-WRIF. Did you have any email you wanted to read? Or
I do. I got one from a couple interesting ones, but I'll read Ben's here. We were talking about global warming, and he says, climate is an average over time. That is their error.
Right. Right, because that's what they tell you. They say, oh, it's cold in Detroit. It must not be. There's no global warming. Or yeah. Anyway, you know, I never finished as so frequently. I never finished really my point on that either, which is that you want to err on the side of, how would you put it, on what would do you ultimately less harm. Like, do we want to keep using fossil fuels even if it doesn't affect global warming? Of course not.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, these people are whack jobs. 313-298-WRIF. And let's go to Rob in Ann Arbor. I think he's driving a cab. Is that right, Rob?
Yeah, I'm driving a cab there, Peter. How you doing,
Rob? I'm doing great. Welcome.
I haven't talked in a while. I used to be with them boys, Motown Rage.
They'll say what?
I used to be with them boys, Motown Rage, that local band.
Oh, yeah. Motown Rage.
Motown Rage. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, they're getting ready to go to this CD. But anyway, I wanted to touch on that global warming, you know. Peter, you're right. They say that it's cold in Detroit. We're not global warming. But what about that 8 square mile iceberg that broke off in Alaska You know, is that global warming, or what, is that just because it's too hot?
And what was the one that was in the paper today? Was it about Greenland?
Well, there is a lot of warming. Their argument is that this is a natural cycle of the Earth, and that there was a huge cooling period, and now things are just beginning to warm up again. Well, I'll tell you, Rob, it's pretty hard for you and me to even figure that out. It does seem to make some sense when you burn a lot of stuff. Yeah, that
right. It has effects. Like, can we talk about cancer?
Yeah. So what? What if it didn't affect global warming? We still would want to get the poisonous effect of coal and oil and uranium.
Yeah, there's a big word there. Yeah. Poison.
Poison. All right. Thank you, Rob. Welcome. Good to hear from you. Let's see. We got lots of callers here. Actually, with the I'm trying to get the people that have been waiting the longest. Here's James and Warren. James, hi. It's Peter and Jeline. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good.
I got a. How long did I get to talk?
What's on your mind?
Well, I was thinking. I got a few concepts as far as the Big Three and the UAW and such. What I was thinking is maybe somebody can answer this. I was always wondering. I got no dog in the fight. You know, I've always bought American because I just thought it was stupid to do anything else, but considering I'm in Metro Detroit. But the short story is, I was wondering why the UAW never had a contract where the employees would have to buy a Big Three, you know, a Big Three car themselves.
Well, don't you think most UAW workers, with the exception of very, very few, do in fact buy union-made cars? I got to say that I've rarely ever seen any UAW worker that had anything other than an American-made car.
And I know you can't park at Solidarity House if you have a foreign car, that's for sure.
All right, thank you. But I don't know. Anybody just empirically seen UAW workers? I mean, I can't believe that someone that works in like a Chevy plant would show up at a Honda.
Well, you know, I have a neighbor who I think works for one of the Big Three, and his little foreign car stays at home.
No, well, there you go. They sure wouldn't bring it
right.
To work.
Well, I don't.
Here's Rod.
Yeah,
and
talk
you're
about
on.
Getting your car keyed.
Hey, Rod. Rod, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey there. Hi. Yeah, I got a couple things. The first one is, like, does the loan to the car companies mean government control of the car companies? And the second one is, what do you think about the talk show by Alex Jones on InfoWars or PrisonPlanet.com? Those would pretty much like to hear your comments about those.
Okay, well, the first one, I'm not sure what all the details are.
A lot of oversight.
Yeah, a lot of oversight. The car companies are going to have to come up with a very explicit plan.
There will be a watchful eye.
Yeah, this was, what was it, 17 point something billion dollars, $18 billion, let's call it. And the government wants to go over it with a fine tooth comb, but when their buddies in the financial sector, which caused all the problems in the first place, they just said, yeah, here's the billions. And it turns out Wall Street still flying its corporate jets crisscrossing the country, may no longer fly in Detroit, says this article, but Wall Street, the coveted executive perk, has hardly been grounded. Six financial firms that received billions in bailout dollars still own and operate fleets of jets to carry executive to company events and sometimes personal trips, according to an Associated Press review. About the Alex Jones thing, I never listened to it.
Yeah, I don't even know what that is.
It's just, I don't know, one of these 9/11 guys in PrisonPlanet.com. It's got the interesting stuff on it. It kind of vacillates between interesting stuff that's on the mark and other stuff that's, as far as I'm concerned, Rod, kind of wacky.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, thank you for listening, and thank you for calling. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And here's Larry. Larry's in Richmond Township. Hi. Welcome to WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Yeah, I'm a longtime listener, and I called a couple of times and had some comments. I'm a UAW worker, and as far as, you know, having cars, you know, in the plants, our plant, you drive around there and you will not see a foreign car in the parking lot at all. Except for we did have one time where a manager had a Toyota had pulled in, which was kind of funny. And then we did a lot of bitching about that. And eventually he pulled out one of his older cars that were, you know, American made. And Yeah, it was kind of funny.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier, Larry, that Julian and I used to work for the UAW, and we broadcast from Solidarity House in on Jefferson in Detroit. And but there was one guy that drove a foreign car. Remember, I can't think of his first name, but he moved out to Oregon.
Oh.
Yeah, I can't think of his first name. I mean, he's got an unusual last name, but I'm trying to lip sync to.
I still can't get it.
But he would pull into the Solidarity House lot with this old funky Mercedes, you know. But,
really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but now another thing too that a lot of people haven't really thought about is, for instance, what got us here to begin with. I mean, here we had, I'm driving in the parking lot, and everybody in that parking lot had brand new vehicles. Nowadays, it seems like people are holding onto their vehicles a lot longer than they want.
Sure.
You know, and but what got us here? You know, what is it that got us here? And they're not looking at that aspect because most of the jobs have been shipped out. Like our plant, we've lost thousands of workers through buyouts, and, you know, they'd scare you into taking a buyout because, you know, you're not going to have your job. You got too low a seniority. You're going to be gone in another year or so.
Well, it's all about blackmail, because that's what they're going to come down. They're going to say, unless you agree to reduce your wages and benefits to the level of these non-union foreign automobile manufacturers in southern states, you're not going to have a job at all. And Gettelfinger just seems to roll over and over and over. And if he dug his heels in, if he got the entire unionized working class to stand behind him, I mean, don't they look at American history? Don't they look at what happens in Europe? I mean, right now, the unions ought to be planning for a general strike. I mean, stop it all. And, I mean, because, you know, that's counter-blackmail. You say, we're going to stop this whole thing. And they say, wait a minute. If you all went on strike now and stopped the entire U.S. economy, it'll collapse. And so then the unions would say, well, then you better give real strict attention to what we want, which means we're not giving up the standard of living that we've earned through our organized effort and the pattern that we've set for the rest of the, the middle class throughout this country. But they don't have the cojones to do it.
Right. Well, another thing, too, is we've given up so much through contracts. Every contract we get, it seems like we are just giving and giving and giving. And it's like, okay, what's the company giving back? And it's like, well, we're giving you the security of, have you been working this week? Well, then you ought to be happy with that.
Well, that's essentially.
I think that's pretty, getting more and more, sadly, in a lot of industries, more common. It's terrible.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call, Larry.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Isn't that horrible in a way I know you said it in such a heartfelt and real manner to say good luck.
Yeah,
I
mean, seriously, but the best.
Why do we have to depend on luck?
Yeah, that's sad.
Yeah, why do we have, after all the hard work all of us have put in every aspect of this economy where we work, all we wanted was a home. I mean, think about these people, the people saying, wow, they didn't, you know, they got in over their head. I mean, people wanted a home, and we're promised it. Here's Bush saying, we're going to have homes for everybody. Home ownership is what's going to be the basis of this country. And we're going to provide all these loans. And, oh, no, here, well, no, I know, there's too much small type. Don't worry. We're going to get you into this nice house and all of that. People that were striving not to be like upper middle class or have some huge home or something like that, but just a home in which they could call their own, where they could feel secure that they went to work every day, and whether they had a small job that people, you know, unfortunately don't have the respect they should have for it, or you know, something that's a little more sexy. We don't deserve what's happening to us because we didn't do it. We weren't lazy. We weren't greedy. We weren't trying to make something out of nothing. We went to work every single day and did what we were supposed to. Why are we suffering?
Yeah, great point.
And you know what? Let me just say this, I'm very clear, or that maybe some of you are already thinking about this. Maybe you're thinking, you know, what do you mean we? Are you suffering, Peter? Well, no, I'm not suffering. Do I think my job is 100% secure? You know what? No. And if I went upstairs and I asked my boss, they'd say, sure, why would you think your job isn't secure? But you know what? His job isn't secure. I wonder if he's listening.
You know what my... you never know. You know what a friend of mine says?
What?
And this is what I'm going to say about my situation. No one is sailing on the Aloha deck right now, except for the fat cats.
You got it.
Yeah.
In fact,
No, the Love Boat. Do you remember the Love Boat?
I've heard of it. I never
saw
it.
Yeah, old show. Yeah.
You want a real aside? Not only did I finally... if all of you have known over the years, I've said, you know, don't watch television, turn it off. I bought a 32-inch...
I don't buy into that, sadly enough.
32-inch flat screen.
Yeah? Are you back on that? You're into it.
And finally got cable.
Oh, I just... I mean, alert the media people. Oh, wait, we are the media.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm telling you, I don't feel too much differently about it.
You
don't?
I
started watching things like CNN and all that, and I went, wow, man. You know, sometimes... I mean, I don't know. I want to learn things. I don't want to necessarily just see people screaming at each other. And watching the 6:30 news or the, you know, like on ABC or NBC or CBS, they distill the day's events into like 4 or 5 minute little segment. And usually.
Oh, it's probably less than that.
You're
right.
Oh, yeah. You're right. You are right.
Yeah.
But since I've already read the newspaper, and I'm not saying everybody should do this. I mean, this is part of my job. That I've read the New York Times, and in a way, why I even watch like the ABC News.
Well, how about breaking news, Peter? Okay. You already know it, right?
Exactly. But I want to see ABC News because I want to see how things are being presented.
Oh yeah, to the masses.
Yeah, I want to see where they put it in the scheme of things, and sometimes even a little interesting. But I could live totally without television, and I sure could live without CNN or MSNBC. I started watching those the few days after I got cable, and I thought, what a waste of time.
It's kind of the same story repeated over and over. You know, are these little Kaylee's remains, days on end?
Oh, and I mean, it's kind of nice to listen to Keith Olbermann go off.
He's wonderful.
Yeah,
I kind of like watching that mean Nancy Grace. Have you ever seen her?
No.
Oh, she's just mean. Yeah. I love her.
Really?
And most people hate her, but for some reason, I find it highly entertaining.
So even although I have the equipment, I'm still not very fond of television. Here's
good
Pat.
For you, Peter. Keep it real, dude.
313-298-WRIF. Here's Pat and Celine. It's Peter and Jalene. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Jalene. I got to say, you guys have a great show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I listen all the time, every Sunday heading into work. And
we appreciate it.
And I'm heading into work right now, and I got to tell you that, where I work at, it's a former Ford plant they're trying to sell it. So they hired me and approximately three quarters of the plant now at $14 an hour. No benefits. The only thing we have
is
major medical.
Oh,
that's the only thing we have until we have a buyer, which has been, for the past 3 years, they've been looking for a buyer for the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what.
See how that's stretched out?
It is a hard life right now. I cannot go out and buy a house. I cannot go out and buy a car.
No, that's $28,000 a year before taxes without overtime, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, it's not all UAW employees make the $28 an hour or $76 with benefits that everybody's talking about.
You know what? And it's good that people like you call in and put it right, make some reality out of it, let people know.
I mean, it'd be great if I could make the $28 an hour. I'm working next to a couple people that do make it because they're still considered a big three employee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is if they take a cut, then I got to take a cut because they're not going to want to pay me being a tier one employee. They're not going to want to pay me as much as they're paying the big three employees. And then when my wage goes down, all these small plants, their wage goes down too.
Yeah, that's what people don't seem to understand, that this is spiraling downward. This is a race to the bottom, and the less people have, the more they can spend. So the less they spend, the more the less products they're going to buy and the less that people are going to be producing them, and on and on and on like that. But the pathological, you know, the crazy part of these conservatives and these Republicans, why they want to destroy the union, is because of politics. As I said earlier in the show, is because the one of the reasons that Obama, that Barack Obama is going to be the president is because of the unions. The unions contribute tens of millions of dollars to the Democratic Party, and they're the foot soldiers. And the Republicans want to destroy the unions for that. And it's like, you know, they don't care what, you know, what else is going to happen. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And I guess we should say best of luck to everybody. By the way, I spoke to a high-ranking manager. We were talking about all this here. And but, you know, we have a lot of high-ranking managers, so I can say that, I think.
In the building?
Yeah. And I said, do you think your job is 100% secure? And they said, I won't even say whether it's a man or a woman, they said no.
Yeah.
I would say I think it probably is. Like, I think my job probably is secure. Yours is probably
secure.
Well,
I don't make very much money, so I think I'm doing pretty okay. We'll see. Knock on wood.
Okay, I was going to say plastic.
Yeah.
Right here at the WRIF control board. Here's a letter from Trollhättan, Sweden. Another Swedish listener.
Hello.
Found our website by accident. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And he's Trollhättan, Sweden, is where the Saabs are being made in a GM-owned plant. About an hour's drive south is the Volvo factory, owned by Ford. Swedish government is ready to bail out both Saab and Volvo, but the U.S. is not, at least until Obama takes office, he says. It's a long email. I'm trying to... if GM and Ford wanted to stay... wanted to, they could have just retooled their factories and started to pump out smaller and more fuel-efficient cars from the European lineup. GM Europe and Ford Europe, who, by the way, have been making profits right until the financial crisis hit, but they did not. Why? To crush the UAW, that's why, and get rid of their pension and health care deals.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, in all of Europe, we have had public health care for generations and is now taken for granted. Basically, the Americans can't go on lowering their taxes and run enormous deficits and just keep lending and borrowing, too. The financial crisis is all about the debt-based finance sector and the end of American production. This is somebody looking at us from Sweden. How come we didn't notice this? And talking about this health care, I went in to an optometrist for a simple eye exam, and which cost me zero. Ahead of me, there was a man.
And lucky you.
Yeah, I know. That because of the health insurance that I have here through the company. And there was a man in front of me, probably in his late 50s. He was walking with a cane. He was bent over. And I could hear a little of the conversation. He said, "Well, I just can't afford that."
Oh, that's awful.
I mean, I felt, you know.
It's horrible.
Here's somebody that's been writing us for a long time, Dewan Ron. He says he wishes us happy holidays and to Ill O'Reilly a good night. He says, "I want to share with you my memories of the final Bush days. I've been unemployed for 4 years and I'm diabetic, so I'm on health care provided from the Family Independence Agency. It does not provide dental care of any kind. The past 2 weeks I've been suffering unspeakable pain from two broken teeth with an exposed nerve. My plan doctor could only give me limited supply of decent painkillers due to the habit-forming nature, and he was encouraging me to get the teeth fixed, which I would have been more than happy to." So he talks about desperate phone calls to family and friends to lend him some money. What I found was a Detroit fireman facing losing his house and car in similar situations. Everybody I called, but my closest friends and family came through loaning me what they could spare, and I got the teeth taken care of, and
good.
I'm not in pain anymore.
Good.
And it's actually, there's, this is somewhat of a double-edged sword. The sharpest edge is the hurt that people are suffering who shouldn't. The point is, I was thinking about how this was like the peasant villages who had pulled together with everything they had to help one person because one person could not help themselves through no choice of their own. Then I see Bush's snickering face on the TV, and I'm reminded also how we're at this point, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world, and I think to myself, I hope he enjoys this holiday season while other people are starving at his feet.
Well, I think it's time to village up, people.
Yeah, all right. Let's see.
Sadly enough.
Here's Alex in Dearborn Heights. Alex, hi, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Welcome.
Hi, how you guys doing?
We're doing good, thank you.
Excellent. Just getting home here. I worked at the Visteon plant in Ypsilanti.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it was unbelievable to walk into a place and, you know, you have all these great ideas of what a union's really like. You know, you hear great pay and great, you know, all the family oriented things about it when you talk to the UAW members. And, you get in there and you see the people, they don't drive. If you work at a Ford plant, you know, you'd feel that 99% of the vehicles that are on the lot would be Ford vehicles, but they're not. And then, you know, you're like, okay, well, just at least it's the big three, you know, but, you gotta remember, where are these cars being built, you know? They're not being built in America. The Grand Prix is a Canadian vehicle. The Ford Windstar was always built in Canada.
Sure.
You know?
And the Canadian government is going to help bail out the Canadian end of the big three production.
Yeah. But that doesn't help out the American worker, which is the problem with everybody saying buy American. Well, right now, American made is foreign made. It's a foreign company, you know?
Well, it's hard to... Is there any car that has 100% American parts and assembly? I don't think so.
Well, out of 100% assembled here, you know, like the F-150s or the Chevy truck series, no, not really. I mean, the closest thing you can get to it is a Harley Davidson, you know?
There you go. Although we can't do much with a Harley in this weather. Sorry to cut you short, but I got to get these spots in before midnight. Thanks for joining us. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's Deals and Deals and get stuff for half price. Or your 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Website
worldwide. 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing, and we want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new MKS, the MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's DEMMER.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury, lease a 2009 Lincoln MKS for $379 a month. Based on an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury lease renewal and $1,969 down plus tax. See dealer for details or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
What if I told you that you could put up a brand new building and save up to half the cost and up to half the time as similar conventional construction? It probably sounds too good to be true. Well, just by picking up the phone, I can prove it to you. If you need retail, office, or warehouse space, or if your church or school wants to expand and save money, you need General Steel. Call today, and we'll prove to you that your new building can go up in about half the time, and you'll save up to half the cost.
Dial 1-800-220-4155.
We'll help you customize your building. You choose the size. You can even add the look of brick, stucco, or stone to achieve the look you want.
If you still think this sounds too good to be true, then pick up the phone and call. The information is free when you call 1-800-220-4155. Call General Steel and find out how you can put up a brand new building in about half the time and save up to half the cost of similar conventional construction. Call now, 1-800-220-4155, 1-800-220-4155.
Between the millions of millionaires in this country and you, simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires, so they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now, 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
What's a WALU?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
But what is a WALU?
Your kid will love it.
So what is a WALU?
WALU is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. So, you know, you can show off your little leaguer just like the pros. It looks great in the bedroom, basement, garage, or anywhere you want to decorate. And it's not just for kids. Get a WALU of your motorcycle or your sports car or boat. For anything you want to show off, it's a WALU. So check it out now at www.wal-theletteru.com. That's wal-theletteru.com. WALU, the perfect gift.
What's a WALU?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
Well, what is a WALU?
Your kid will love it.
So, what is a WALU?
All right, we've been over this before, but it does bear repeating. A WALU is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. Imagine the possibilities. Whatever you have that you want to show off, it's a WALU. Look for the WALU ad on WRIF.com.
101 WRIF at WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, welcome back to our second segment of WRIF's Night Call, our Eat the Rich segment. Poor little rich girl, Paris Hilton, lost $2 million in jewelry in a break-in. A man in a hooded sweatshirt and gloves. How do they know
that's
that?
Original.
Yeah, forced. Maybe it was the Unabomber. Remember him?
Yes.
He's locked up.
From that guy.
No, he's in federal prison. The burglary came just a day after Paris debuted her new car, a pink Bentley.
No.
You know the difference, I think this is correct, the difference between a Bentley and a Rolls Royce?
What?
The grill and the hood ornament.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, it's like a Bentley for those that feel diffident. What the hell is diffident?
I don't know.
But I mean, in other words, you don't want to be real ostentatious. You don't want to really lord it over people with a Rolls, so you get a Bentley. And these cars now, I think they cost, I don't know, someone give us a shout out. I think they cost like a minimum of like $200,000 for a car.
Just a drop in the hat. Come on.
Also in the New York Times today, are the rich suffering as much as the middle class and the working class? There was a full page ad for Ralph Lauren doggy coats.
What?
Yeah, with the Ralph Lauren crest on it and a little, what's the thing he's known for? Something, this special piping. Also, Barney's, which sounds like a discount place, is actually one of the more expensive stores in New York City. And they got this new campaign, Have a Happy Hippie Christmas. And they're selling peace signs for $1,500.
Remember when I started telling you that this was becoming a commercial thing?
What, the peace sign?
Yes. I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, everyone wears the peace sign. And, you know, I guess the more we see it, glad the message is getting out there. But, you know, people are making a lot of money off of it when we really, let's put all that energy to really bring about some peace, right? Did I tell you about the Nicole Buffett article?
No.
Speaking of Eat the Rich, it's the granddaughter of Warren Buffett. And he
may be one of the richest, may have surpassed Gates in wealth.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And well, for the first time in 15 years, he did get that title, according to Forbes, it says. $62 billion. And remember, he gave all of that money away? Yeah, all of it, right.
Wait. If he has $62 billion, why doesn't he just give $18 billion to the car companies.
Well, he won't even help his own granddaughter, who I love it, is a dreadlocked hippie artist and lives in like a commune artist commune.
Where's a peace sign?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But she's the real deal. She apparently did some kind of a documentary. And Jamie Johnson, who's the heir to Johnson & Johnson.
Right.
He did this documentary. It was about wealth, and it was called The 1%. And she was asked how her grandfather would react to seeing her, because she was on it, on the documentary. She said, "I fear judgment. Money is the spoke in my grandfather's wheel of life." And he cut her off. And you know what's amazing, though? The guy still lives in the house that he bought for $31,500 in 1958. He still lives.
This is Buffett?
Buffett.
Yeah.
And drives an American-made car, believes in holding on to the values he grew up with. And
but that's greed?
He says that he, eschews the usual trappings of obscene wealth.
Yeah, well, it sounds like he does.
And he said that he wanted his kids to have enough money to be able to do the things they want to do, but not enough to not do anything.
Well, now, if you take, like, his wealth, Gates's wealth, the excess wealth, let's say that in order to, you know, being this obscene level of success, that people would get $1 billion. So why doesn't the government have a tax structure where everything over $1 billion in wealth, which you could buy absolutely anything and everything, then it goes back into the general fund? Well, I don't think we'd have any problem. That and cut the defense budget in half would be okay. But listen to this. Governor David A. Patterson of New York, he's the guy that took over after Elliot Spitzer got...
Oh, yeah, Saturday Night Live got into some trouble for portraying him. Oh, yeah.
That made blind jokes. Yeah. He rolled out 137 proposed tax and fee increases last week on items including iTunes downloads and soft drinks, but there could very well be another big one to come. So it's all, you know, like every other state, the state is hurting for funds. So they're going to raise taxes on all of us, on the ordinary people. Now, here's the other big one. Increasing income taxes on the richest residents of New York is still a last resort, Mr. Patterson said in an interview, but one that may be necessary as a result of the state's precarious financial condition. Now, why isn't this the first resort? I don't get it. You're going to tax, and I can't remember, I don't know if it has a list of all the other things, but it's everything under the sun that you and I use in our daily the comings and goings and buying stuff and what have you. And he says, the governor said that increasing taxes on the rich should be the last place you want to go because it automatically kicks in less job creation and leads to people leaving the state, and that risk could become a reality if we have further deficit problems. This is a Democrat, folks. This is not some conservative Republican. Why in the world would taxing the wealthy mean less jobs? Because you know what? They don't use it for job creation. They don't expand, particularly in a climate like that.
Yeah.
They're not going to expand industrial production or the service sector. What they would have done previously, I don't know what the hell they're doing with all their money now.
No, I know. They're going to the Turks and the Caicos, and they're building that pool in their backyard.
Right. They would have invested it, probably with Bernie Madoff, Madoff with all of their money.
What was that called? The Ponzi scheme.
The Ponzi scheme, right. So why this guy would be repeating this is so far beyond me. They are going to do a little bit of a number on wealthier New Yorkers. They're going to have new taxes. Are you ready for this? This is really commie stuff, right? Really.
Yeah, uh-huh.
They're going to tax yachts and furs.
Ooh.
Oh, man, this guy's mean. Anyway, I don't get this. So this is what I was saying.
I don't get furs anyway.
No, we're not responsible for this. The average person in New York, I know some of you are listening in New York because I get email from you, that you're the ones that are going to pay. Why aren't the people that are doing the absolute best, who have the ability to, buy things like coats for their dogs from Ralph Lauren and buy peace signs
so
for...
repulsive.
How much did I say that peace sign cost?
Oh, I don't think you even said that.
$1,500.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, that's something my sister would have.
You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And there's actually, I can't remember, is it peacebuttons.com? Something, a friend of ours here in Detroit.
They're black buttons with the white peace sign.
Yeah, so the traditional one, right, you can get it. But this is the big thing. So tax the rich eat the rich. They're eating us. And we've got to take a stand. It is a war.
I thought it was interesting. Someone emailed you and said, well, what do you consider rich, Peter? I don't understand. I know a lot of people who have quite a bit of money, but you're not talking about...
We're talking the upper 5%, particularly the upper 1%.
Well, and especially people in the large corporations, the CEOs who are taking all of those huge bonuses and...
Still getting them.
Still getting them, that's right.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to our phones. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. And here's Jim in Brighton. Jim, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Yeah, how you guys doing?
Doing good.
Great, thank you.
I just had a couple things to say about the auto industry. Basically, almost my whole family's worked for Ford. My grandpa, my father, my brother, two of my uncles. And
you?
No, actually, by the time I was old enough, you basically need a college education to get on the assembly line.
Really?
And pretty much, there's no more of that, know somebody to get in there,
Yeah.
But I just remember my grandfather saying, the Japanese are going to try to take over this country without firing a single shot, and him telling me how after Pearl Harbor, Ford closed down a bunch of their plants to build tanks to go fight the Japanese. And after 9/11, Ford, GM, Chrysler all donated millions of dollars to funds and families of 9/11 and gave New York City fire trucks, ambulances, things like that.
Uh-huh.
And none of the foreign car companies, not one of them, donated $1 to any of the causes after 9/11. And people... I think they underappreciate what these car makers have done for this country, A lot of people say, oh, they don't deserve a bailout and, I wish I could get some free money and blah, blah, blah. And, these people driving around in foreign cars wonder why the economy's so bad. They should take a look at the car they're driving and say, well, maybe I had a piece in that. They should be smacking themselves in the head, right?
Jim, one of the things they do and people I know are worried about, like everything from the Michigan Opera Theater to this free concert called the Concert of Colors and the African American Museum, all get big donations from Chrysler.
Really?
Yeah. So, and I know the Concert of Colors, that's a free concert 2 or 3 days in July with tremendous acts.
I hope these things don't go away.
They may get zero. Aww. They may get zero. The Opera Theater is worried as well. But thanks for all that, Jim. Appreciate it. Actually, some open lines, too. 313-298-WRIF. I was reading these two other articles, and I find these things in here. I mean, you might as well. I mean, I'm not that bright. I just read the paper, and there they are jumping out at you. But normally, these aren't the kind of things that you may hook into. Georgia lags in its bid to fix Army.
Now, and we're not talking about Atlanta.
Yeah, we're not talking about Atlanta. We're talking about that country over by Russia, whose army was routed in August during this brief war with Russia, and it suffers from widespread mismanagement and unqualified leadership. This is the military. And is in need of extensive reforms to become a modern fighting force, according to a classified Pentagon assessment conducted this fall. Everybody kind of takes this for granted, that our nation is making military assessments of other nations. No other country in the world does that.
Against Russia, making the Russians mad at us all over again.
Well, the assessment by a team of military officers that worked quietly in the Capitol in October, November, offers a clinical view of a politicized military culture and substandard practice and blah, 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 blah. The assessment underscores the difficulties to be faced by President-elect Barack Obama, whose foreign policy team will be balancing decisions on how to engage Georgia against concerns that commitments to assist its military will further inflame Russia. Well, what I'm interested in here, sure, it will inflame Russia. Why in the hell would we be arming a nation directly on the border of another country which it's already had a military conflict with? It would be like, I can't even China arming Mexico if Mexico and the United States weren't getting along. But what I'm interested in here is this is going to be hundreds of millions of dollars of our tax money, yours and mine, that at a particularly at a time like this.
For a country that a lot of people don't even know it exists.
Yeah. And in actually, this country. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be airing an interview I did earlier with Frieda Berrigan. She wrote this report, or co-authored it, called U.S. Weapons at War 2008, Beyond the Bush Legacy, which discusses how the military-industrial complex essentially steals our tax dollars and winds up sending them to other countries.
Which is all business.
Yep. Same thing here. Russia, testing U.S. sway, offers Lebanon 10 warplanes. And yeah, that's not usually the kind of article you go, oh, boy, I want to really read that.
It's not very sexy.
Yeah. But the United States is Lebanon's main military partner. But American plans to help rebuild the country's army and air force are moving slowly. And Russia's moving. We're rebuilding the armed services of Georgia, of Lebanon, of Poland. This was part of the deal. Now, one of the things, of course, that happens when you get into NATO, and if you stay up for the interview, you learn from Frieda Berrigan, if you get brought into NATO, everybody has to have the similar weaponry, or the same weaponry, which is U.S. weapons.
Yeah, true.
So this is the military-industrial complex. And this is, let's see, United States is the world's top arms-supplying nation, selling more than $32 billion in foreign military sales, a nearly threefold increase over 2005. A startling 154 of the world's 193 nations received arms, military training, or other military assistance from the U.S. over the period study. More than $108 billion in security assistance funding was authorized between fiscal years 2002 and 2009. And besides the fact that these weapons undermine human rights big time, see, one of the things that happens, this is called military Keynesianism. Keynes was a English economist who said that in a modern capitalist economy, the government had to be the pump primer with expenditures. And he had in mind particularly infrastructure stuff, roads, because like the whole interstate highway system was at once based on national security, but also it was a big gift to the auto manufacturers. You know, the farther you could go, the quicker you go, the more that people would buy cars. And that was known. So what it is, we produce wealth at work, we get paid, and then taxes are taken out. Taxes are then transferred to the government, and the government could send it back to our communities, make sure that we have great schools and great roads, that we don't have a $300 million deficit like we now have in Detroit, just announced, and what have you. Or it could be sent as grants. Let me see. It has the five biggest recipients. Pakistan, who we've given $3.7 billion to in 06 and 07. Turkey, $3 billion. I mean, we got to give money to Turkey, right?
Really?
Yeah. Israel gets $2.1 billion, Iraq $1.4 billion, Colombia $500 million. Now, this money is granted to them, and so then they buy military hardware, right? They take these military grants. It's not, we're not like helping their people or anything like that. Foreign aid, we're helping the starving people.
I mean, that's right.
There's a little of that, but not really. Essentially, it's a theft of the wealth we create in order to finance these industries. Well, you say, but wait a minute. If they're producing planes and guns and tanks and the rest of the boom, boom stuff, there's workers working there, aren't there? And isn't that part of the economy? Well, it unfortunately is a huge but pretty unproductive sector of the U.S. economy. Here's what it is. It's capital intensive rather than labor intensive. So is that clear on the face of it? What it means is if you're building an F-14 or something like that, I can't even remember what one of them cost, and I don't want to exaggerate, but I mean, millions and millions of dollars for one. And,
wow.
And it doesn't take so many people to assemble it as it does all the parts, the cost of the parts and what have you. As opposed to a lot of other work, construction, if you're building bridges and doing roads and new schools and, creating ferry lines across the Great Lakes, which is one of my things I always want to happen, like out of about six of them, right? That's labor intensive. And that would be, so you don't get much of a bang for your buck. Also, the entire so-called defense industry, really, they used to call it the war industries more correctly, it's so filled with corruption and mismanagement.
It really is.
And sometimes when these companies get caught, like Lockheed Martin, And they say, oh, you were just ripping us off, and you were charging us, you know, $900 for an ashtray and what have you. They go,
right.
We're fining you $1.5 million. And they, you know, they hang their heads. They go, oh, yeah. And then they get the next contract. So more on that at 1 a.m. with Frieda Berrigan, who is actually the daughter. I don't think this, I don't want to go into this, but if it means anything to you, you might want to Google this name. Her father was Philip Berrigan, who is still alive.
One of the Berrigan brothers. Priests, right?
Yeah, priests who were these big anti-war priests. The Mary Knoll, I think. But no, actually, her father, Philip, has passed away, and her uncle. What the hell is his name? Philip and...
Oh, boy.
Hey, he's the famous one, too.
Yeah, exactly.
313-298-WRIF. Open lines for you as well. Here's Andre in Detroit. Hi, Andre.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Andre.
I have just a few questions for you guys. And basically, all my family have been UAW workers. I'm a proud member of UAW Local 174 myself. When we went to war, President Bush took us into war. That war drove up the price of fuel, and the Big Three could no longer sell those SUVs. So, I believe that the Bush administration, they hold some accountability for that too. And, two, about 9/11.
Sure.
I wanted just to get your take on this and let you guys go. 9/11, in order to make the United States safe, when those planes crashed into the World Trade Center, the United States never asked the reason why. We never asked ourselves why. And we needed to do that in order to find out. So, to get the answer to that so it wouldn't never happen or repeat itself again.
Mm-hmm.
And two, when President Bush was at Yale University, that he belonged to a secret society called the Bonesmen.
Yeah.
Skull and Bones.
Skull and Bones. And the members were the Bonesmen, yeah.
Yeah, the Bonesmen.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to see what was your take on far as the agenda behind that with him leading this country.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Andre. 313-298-WRI. A lot was made about the fact that the rich have all these little societies. Skull and Bones Society at Yale, where Bush hung out for a while. I guess, didn't he get a, what do they call that thing in business? A BA? No.
Uh-huh.
There's a...
Wait, we are so bad.
What, did you ever graduate?
I did. I have a BA in journalism.
Yeah. I have. I took time and space or something. But an MBA, that's what it is.
MBA, thank you.
Yeah. And also, thank you.
Rocket Science is here at the Night Call Show.
Thank you for people that called in about the radical peace priest, Daniel Berrigan, who is the uncle of Frieda Berrigan, who will be our guest at 1 a.m. And the first one, of course, Bush bears immense responsibility for this debacle. I mean, they cut taxes. They ended they cut taxes on the wealthy during Bush's years. He started this war, which was absolutely unnecessary, based on lies, didn't liberate anybody. It enslaved people in the sense that their country has been destroyed with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of casualties. You know, 4,500 of ours or so are casualties, 35,000 when you include our wounded as well. And also ended regulation to an extent dreamed of only by Reagan, who'd begun this all. So, yeah, he bears major responsibility. The war, no one talks about that anymore. The war is going to wind up costing over $2 trillion. Bush also, though, he has been focusing on his legacy, and he said on Wednesday that there can be no debate about his record of preventing another terrorist attack. He invoked the harrowing memories of September 11th and said no one could have predicted back then that the country would not be hit again for the rest of its pregnant presidency.
Sorry. Yeah.
I give good slips.
He says it wasn't just luck.
Yeah. It's not a matter of luck, he said, defending his security policy. Addressing a supportive military audience at the U.S. Army War College, have you ever noticed that in the last 5 or 6 years that he nor Cheney have ever spoken anywhere other than in front of a military audience?
Been doing a lot of it, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Talk about fascistic.
Yeah,
right?
Really.
And I'm not trying to say the Army is fascistic. I'm saying that when someone is oriented around the least democratic institution in this society, where the only place that he can get a sympathetic hearing, well, what does it say? But in any event,
yeah.
Let's do this, and I don't even necessarily do this, but let's do this. Let's give old Bush the benefit of the doubt and say that he put in place security measures, and forgetting about the torture, forgetting about the violation of the Geneva Conventions, forgetting about common decency, forgetting about the disgrace that Bush and Cheney have brought upon the United States because of its torture policies and holding people forever under the most horrid conditions and all of that. That because of their policy, there weren't any more terror attacks. What about September 11th? Under whose reign did that occur? Who ignored totally warning after warning, including specific warnings that Al-Qaeda was going to strike in the U.S., and they did absolutely nothing after they were told time and time and time again? George W. Bush bears responsibility for 9/11. By the way...
And he bears responsibility for targeting the wrong country.
Yeah. Speaking of targeting, those shoes. Oh! We could have played the Eagles.
My favorite story.
We could have played the Eagles song. Isn't it called Those Shoes or something?
You're the true classic rocker in this room, Peter.
Hey, you want to hear Jalene and I play classic rock? Go to Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Go to the left, and you'll see what we're talking about. The most I can tell you on this program.
You know how to rock.
Anyway, a pair of black leather Oxfords hurled at President Bush in Baghdad produced a gasp heard around the country, around the world, in fact. A Turkish cobbler had a different reaction. They were his shoes. He said he made them. They were produced at specific styles, which I personally designed for 10 years, so I couldn't have missed it. No way, said Ramazan Baydan, Baydan. So now it's called the Bush shoe, and...
It's 11 ounces each. They're really lightweight.
Well, they couldn't even have heard them then.
Well, yeah, but it says a clunky design. I don't know. I didn't really see it. He said the guy who makes the shoes said he was amazed by their aerodynamics.
Wow.
Well, now, my favorite story.
If I would have thrown my shoes at him, these huge boots I'm wearing.
Yeah, it would have hurt.
Yeah,
that would have left a mark.
That would have been like attempted murder.
Yeah, right.
Their new run of 15,000 pair of these shoes are destined for Iraq. Let's see. A British distributor has asked to become the Biden Shoe Company's European sales representative with a first order of 95,000 pairs.
Can you believe this?
And an American company has placed an order for 18,000 pairs. Yeah.
Last year they sold 19,000 pairs at $40 each. So this is a windfall. Like, unexpected windfall at the end of the year for these people.
It's pretty, yeah, and all over the world, people are demonstrating with shoes. Huge, and on my website, there's a great photo of a guy with like a big, you know, what do you call it, model shoe, about 3 feet high.
Wasn't it unbelievable? I couldn't believe it. And really, though, I like the last sentence.
What's that?
And it says, noting the spike in sales, Serkan Turk, Biden's general manager, says, Mr. Bush served some good purpose to the economy before he left.
This is not Biden in the sense of Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, right.
Maybe more Biden.
Maybe Biden.
B-A-Y-D-A-N. In Montreal, people marched the U.S. Embassy and threw shoes over the gates of it.
Oh, yeah. People are really enjoying the shoe story.
Yeah. But speaking of the war budget, I am, and I always say, cut the war budget in half, stop all these wars. But, and I thought, wow, I'm being really radical. But William A. Owens, who was a retired Navy admiral, who was vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 94 to 96, he said in today's New York Times that Can Barack Obama keep the Defense Department's budget at the extraordinary levels of the last 7 years with the spreading recession? The answer is no. Can he make cuts without jeopardizing national security and the safety of our troops? The answer is yes. But, he's got to be prodded. The American war machine that swept away the Saddam Hussein regime was built during the 8 years of the Clinton presidency for about $300 billion a year. George W. Bush has added more than $1 trillion over the past 8 years, not including money that went to Afghanistan and Iraq. And he talks about in here, which you've probably heard me say before, that the United States, I didn't mark this, but everyone else's budget in the world pales before ours. There's no need to spend all this, although this has become the key to the economy. And again, as Frieda Berrigan will tell us at 1 a.m., what companies like Lockheed Martin does is they put offices and facilities in as many congressional districts as possible. So if you say, well, there's this F-22, this plane that is absolutely unnecessary that was going to be created in case the Soviet Union, remember them? When did they go away? 1991. In case the Soviet Union created a superior MiG fighter plane. Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing like that. All the I can't remember. The F-10s, F-14s, I get them confused with our trucks.
Big-ass expensive planes.
Exactly. So those planes that are in the U.S. Air Force right now are more than capable to take down anything any other country could launch against us.
Yeah.
So this F-22...
Well, with the money they spend, if it wouldn't, I'd be...
Yeah. So the F-22 is this total boondoggle, but then but everybody says, wait a minute, you know, if you close that down, we're going to lose our jobs. You know? So we are... Here's the blackmail again, you know? Mm. Either take wage cuts, UAW people, or are you going to go under completely? We don't need this plane, and we could use this money for something that would provide more jobs, 10 times more jobs, you know? You're going to create unemployment in our district, you know? So this is it. The whole system now is based on blackmail. We've got to find an equation that turns this all around and start making some sense, because this system has become out of control, absolutely out of control. I'm out of control, too. So is Jillian Jordan. We'll be right
always
back to get your calls. 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
There.
The pictures,
the podcast,
the blog,
the special features you just won't get
anywhere else. Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall lose yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again, too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help get you out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
How would you like to lose weight for free? Hi, I'm Steve Bostick for Right Size Smoothies.
And I'm Scott Johnson. For a few months now, we've offered an incredible deal to the public. Use Right Size Free for 2 full weeks and see how much weight you can lose before you pay for them.
But some of you haven't called, so we're offering one last chance to take advantage of this popular offer. These people called.
I lost weight within a couple days. Now I'm down 120 pounds.
A free trial sounded like a no-brainer, so I called. Within the first week, I'd lost a lot of weight.
I knew within a few days I finally found the answer. I've lost 44 pounds.
Right Size Smoothies contain an appetite manager that knocks out hunger cold. You'll see results early, so you'll know you can do it.
How much weight can you lose in 2 weeks? Try Right Size Free and find out. You could be our next testimonial.
For your free 2-week trial, call 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan, my co-host. By the way, I was talking earlier, shocking everyone, that not only did I get a big flat-screen TV, but also got cable.
Yeah, Peter, you're such a sellout. I don't know if I can, you know.
But I did see one thing that I was really, you have cable, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that they have on Animal Planet, the channel. They have the Sea Shepherds.
I watched
Whale Wars.
A good part of it. And our friend, Captain Paul Watson, who is in charge of Sea Shepherd, has headed it up and all of that. They show him, and they're going after the Japanese
whaling ships.
Yeah, yeah, who are whaling illegally.
Yeah, in a whale sanctuary down around Antarctica. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society ship, Steve Irwin, now has the entire Japanese whaling fleet on the run, according to this latest release, because you can get all this. And they have these encounters, and they bomb. Hold on here.
It's like oil.
They have this, yeah, rotten butter bombs.
Right, that's what it is. They're not harmful to people.
No, they ruin the whale meat. And, I mean, these are these beautiful whales that are supposed to be protected, but they say they're doing it for research. So,
yeah, and that's the only thing they hide behind, that they have.
Captain Paul says, it looks like Whale Wars season number 2 is officially underway. I guess he's playing to the media, huh?
Well, you know what? That's great, because he needs more attention for what he does.
Yeah, it's seashepherd.org.
And, gosh, Peter, how long have you been talking about Sea Shepherd?
Yeah, you know, we almost always, we give very, very few presents out. In fact, what we do is take the money that we would buy.
For the holidays.
For the holidays, yeah. And instead of buying gifts, this is terrible. I'm sinking the economy single-handedly. We give it over to the Sea Shepherd in people's name. I wonder what they think. They probably go, yeah, I bought them a present. They're giving money to people.
No, they probably feel lesser of a human being for not doing the same.
You're right. All right, let's go through our calls because we're in our last segment. Here's Elisa, or is it, am I saying it right? Elisa in Waterford.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Elisa.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Good. What's up?
I just wanted to bring up a subject. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in Arkansas, they just put a new law in effect that if you are a couple and you are not married, you are not allowed to adopt.
Oh, yeah, that happened in a few states, didn't it, Peter?
Sure. It was mostly aimed at gays.
But yes, exactly. And they tried to make it sound equal, and they said, oh, it's for all couples.
Yeah.
Not just gay couples. It's for straight couples also.
Mm-hmm.
But I was watching something on the internet the other day that my friend sent me, and it was a Republican speaking, and he said, we made it appear to be for everyone. But we were really trying to target the same-sex marriages.
That is just so not surprising.
Same-sex couples, really,
yeah.
Because most of them can't get married.
Couples.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really sad. And what did you call it, Peter, about the South?
That's what I like about the South. I don't know. Yeah,
no,
I got relatives.
It's a Southern psychopathology.
I find that very, I don't know why they would do something like that when they know that in, you know, about maybe 80% of America is, like, you know, of the countries, 80% of in America, it is illegal for same sexes to marry.
No, I think, wait, more than that.
Elisa. Yeah, yeah, and I just picked up a friend from the airport who lives a lot of the time in California.
Yeah.
And he was telling me tonight on the way home just about everything with Proposition 8 that's going on out there and just how much more it's being talked about out there. But really, the war on gay people is in
high gear.
Yeah, high gear. And it is just disconcerting.
And Barack Obama has invited one of the generals of the anti-gay movement to give the invocation at his inauguration.
Yeah, Rick Warren, who's that, he's an evangelist, isn't he?
Well, he has a big church. He's an evangelical Christian.
And he's a homophobe. That's what he is.
Yeah, but he says he loves gay people.
Oh, yeah. He does that whole statement, and anyone of color can relate to this. Who's, you know, anyone
he loves
with
Muslims, people of other religions.
I have gay friends, you know.
Yeah. He says you don't have to see eye to eye to walk hand in hand.
I'll tell you what. I am so annoyed that these inaugurations are like a church service. I'm going to watch Barack Obama's portion of it, but I'm going to have other people in the room and I'm going to say, listen, during these parts, I'm not even watching it.
All right, Elisa, thank you very much.
I'm boycotting the invocation and the benediction.
The benediction is bookended by, by an old civil rights, Joseph Lowry, who is Reverend Joseph Lowry, who is on the other side of the coin, and he thinks there should be gay marriage. But let me just read to you for about the 19th time Article 6 annotations of the U.S. Constitution, which says, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. So couldn't they just solve this? I mean, I don't know that this violates the Constitution, the fact that they have an invocation and a benediction, whatever the hell that is.
Well, why are they praying Christian style in something that represents the entire nation when we are such a diverse nation? I'm not a Christian, you're not a Christian, and I know there's a lot of people in Detroit who are not Christians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing wrong with being Christian, but don't put it in my government.
Right. Keep your religion off my government.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. Well, how about this? Alone among major Western nations, the United States has refused to sign a declaration presented Thursday at the United Nations calling for worldwide decriminalization of homosexuality.
Yeah, basically saying you won't be killed if you're gay around the world, which you often are.
Yeah, and more than 70 UN members outlaw homosexuality, and in several of them, homosexual acts can be punished by execution. It was co-sponsored by France and the Netherlands, was signed by all 27 European Union members as well as Japan, Australia, Mexico, and three dozen other countries. There was broad opposition from Muslim nations and the United States.
Yes.
George W. Bush's United States said, oh, we're right with you, Muslim fundamentalists.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's just like all of these important pieces of legislation, like the Kyoto Treaty. You know, we're number one in going against what's
the rest
good
of the world.
Yes, and the rest of the world.
All right, here's Mike and Lapeer. Mike, hi, it's Peter and Jaleen.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good. What's up?
Good. Hey, I'm just going to keep this short and sweet. First of all, I just want to say that I love your guys' show, and I really appreciate you guys. You're a great source of information for everyone.
Yeah,
thank you.
You're welcome. I'm just going to go ahead and ask this question, then I'll hang up so I can hear your response. But is it just me, or does it seem like after 9/11 happened that they didn't have, like, I guess, interviews on TV of people who were family members of people, you know, that died on the planes? I just didn't really notice
that. Yeah, it was very small. There were only a couple who maybe created organizations.
We used to interview those people with 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrow.
Yeah, but they weren't on the mainstream media, probably.
No, no.
Right.
They were only on shows like this.
I mean, I just found it kind of weird, but I just wanted to hear what you guys thought about it.
Weird.
Yeah, it is weird. Yeah, you know, they don't show us the nitty-gritty watch those shows.
The full story of 9/11 has not been told. Hey, the full story of the Kennedy assassination has not been told.
Well, they've tried.
All right.
And tried.
Thank you
and
very
tried.
Much.
And tried.
Hey, just real quickly, let me just go through. I can't resist this, but Sarah Palin, remember her? You know, doesn't this sound Sarah Palin?
How could we forget?
Well, but it sounds like she's like as far back in history as Monica Lewinsky.
We wish.
Yeah.
But, bring back Monica.
It's the gift. It's the gift that keeps on giving. Wasilla resident Sherry L. Johnston, mother of Bristol Palin's boyfriend, has been busted on an OxyContin-related arrest at her home by Alaska State Troopers.
More Palin scandal.
Yeah, Johnston is the mother of Levi Johnston, who Governor Sarah Palin said was the father of Bristol Palin's unborn child. Levi Palin, Johnston.
Sarah Palin's daughter, who is 18, who is having the baby.
Yeah.
Any day now.
Could you imagine if this would have been Barack Obama?
Oh, they would have just... The evil race card would have come out in such a big way.
Here's a good website, atlargely.com. And the author, who I don't know who it is, says, think about this for a moment. Here you have Johnston, whose son has knocked up Palin's teenage daughter, allegedly manufacturing and delivering drugs during a presidential campaign in which Palin is running for vice president of the United States. Palin, at this point, is still governor of Alaska. Did no one think to do a background check on the family of a boy soon to marry the daughter of a governor? Also, and a final note on all of that, and this again, this just seems like so yesterday. Joe the Plumber, old Samuel Rosenbacher, has authored a book called Joe the Plumber, Fighting for the American Dream. It's a memoir. What is it like?
I mean, we are going to run right out there and buy that one.
What is it, 2.5 pages in large type?
That guy needs to just, this maybe will be his final performance.
I think so. Rosenbacher was held up by McCain's campaign as an example of an American worker who would be hurt economically by Barack Obama's election, which, of course, wasn't true. And if he was an owner, he's not a worker. Rosenbacher endorsed McCain and joined him on the campaign trail, but he criticizes McCain in his book and says he did not want him as the Republican presidential nominee.
This guy's a whack job.
Yeah. Can we say...
Take 15 minutes of fame? Can we say trying to make a buck?
Goodbye to bad rubbish.
Bye-bye, Joe the not plumber.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Here's Gonzo in Pontiac. Gonzo, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. Welcome to WRIF.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing?
Good.
I was just curious. Is that, does nobody understand that's a loan to the big three? It's not a gift. It's a loan, right?
It's a loan. You're right. It's not a gift, not a bailout.
They call it a bridge loan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and as anybody remembers, Iacocca and Chrysler done proved back in the 70s that we pay our loans back.
Well, I hope history repeats itself. You know, we're looking at there was a company that was in trouble. Now we have an economy that's in trouble. So the worst case scenario is pretty frightening, but let's just hope things turn out okay. Thank you, Gonzo.
And what's Iacocca doing now? Making Olivia.
What's that mean?
That's that, like, olive oil-based margarine.
That's the stuff that says it causes anal leakage.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Well,
what do you mean he's making it?
It's his product. I'm pretty sure it's his product. He's responsible for anal leakage.
Really? I don't know if it says it on the package, but that was, in some cases, that could occur.
Yeah, it's like
kind of slid
that fat-free stuff.
I don't think we want to continue this conversation. All right. Here's Billy. Billy's in Roseville. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. What's up, Julie?
Hey.
Hey,
my buddy Jared and I, we were talking about a subject about how our economy is kind of in a dwindling state right now. Pretty sure both of you would agree.
What?
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
The lack of not...
Spiraling.
The lack of jobs, just the emotions of people. You know, it's a really down time right now around here. And we were kind of wondering what you thought about it and what you might think some of the reasons were that the government kind of steers away from legalizing cannabis, marijuana, to, virtually create a multi-million-dollar industry overnight. I mean, I'm exaggerating that. But
so there's more weed, less war. More weed, less war.
Right.
Exactly.
I don't know. It's just an idea.
So many more jobs. I mean, there's so much good when you weigh the pros and cons.
Well, you know, Billy, actually, they have what they call the black economy, the underground or the illegal economy. Its sales is up in the billions of dollars. So, to some extent, the only thing that's missing is it getting taxed. by the government. Well, there is such enormous prejudice, although it's waning. I mean, think about how Michigan just legalized medical marijuana. And I don't think it's just because people saw it as something that would be an effective adjunct to traditional medicine, but rather it was a way of saying, look, we know this is stupid. The drug war is a war on our neighbors. Some people really make some bad decisions about intoxicants, bad choices, primarily alcohol, which is legal, cigarettes, if that's not really much of an intoxicant. But you know, a lot of addictive properties are sold legally. And marijuana, the most harmless of them all, has been its function has been to essentially create clients for the prison industrial complex. And even if a substance was harmful, I think a government ought to. But on the other hand, desired by so many people, millions and millions of people, that there ought to be warnings about it, particularly strong intoxicants like alcohol, and as there is on if you look on a bottle.
Is there?
Yeah, doesn't it say about?
I don't know.
Or is that? Is, yeah, don't they always talk about if you're pregnant?
I don't read it. I just drink it.
You just drink it, right? people ought to be careful about those things, and many people aren't. Many people aren't careful about alcohol. Many people aren't, careful about illegal substances. But one of the things about the illegal substance of marijuana, if you you can do a whole lot of it, and as long as you're not doing things like driving.
Yeah, exactly.
Are going to work.
I draw the line there.
Yeah, are going to work where they do, urine tests or something like that. No one's been able to show the harm. So there's all these kind of 20th century prejudices. Everything from
I was talking about drinking.
Well, I was thinking about,
where are you?
Thank you, Billy. I don't know. I was just thinking about
which drug are you talking about?
Well, you know, I was thinking all this stuff, the prejudice against gay. I mean, think about it. We had all this prejudice. If you think about women, the prejudice against women taking part in what were men's occupations, everything from fire and police to broadcasters and, you know, 50 years ago, you would never see a woman broadcasting.
Even in the 70s, remember that one broadcaster? She wrote that book, Too Old, Too Something and Something Deferential to Men. I can't remember what her name was, but
yeah.
Even in the 70s, women were.
So, and the struggle that people of African origin have had to wage and gay people now, and most of the struggles aren't even over.
That's so true. That's, sadly enough, far from it.
So, it goes on. Here's, I'm sorry, I don't have your first name here. Hi, it's Peter and Jolene. Who's this?
Scott.
Scott.
Hi, Scott.
How are you doing?
We're doing good.
Great.
Oh, wait a minute, Scott. Let me just, we found out about Olestra.
Olivio. No, it's Olivio is the name of the
But
product.
It's Olestra gives you anal leakage, not Olivio.
Yeah, Leah Iacocca probably wouldn't appreciate our assumptions.
Oh, okay, Olivio, because, he's Italian, right? So they do olive oil. But is this Roger that wrote olive oil gross?
Oh.
Olive oil's wonderful.
Love olive oil.
Olestra gives you anal leakage, not olive.
Okay, stay Olivio. Away from the Olestra.
Yeah. No, I meant in the butter. I don't know. Never mind. All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
And you do look healthier than I'm drooling.
You're drooling?
Oh, drooling.
You're
a druid?
Drooling. Now, Peter, I talked to you probably about 2 years ago, and it was respect to George Bush and the Klan going into Iraq and Halliburton and the man that can shoot his buddy in the face.
Oh, Cheney.
I'd have to be checked by any law enforcement for 8 hours or 10 hours, and that was all wrong. And then we got into, there was a special girl, maybe it was you, Julie, was talking about the fuel prices. And the fuel prices, oh, you know how skyrocketed our fuel prices went?
Sure.
All the way up. But at the same time, we had to have those fuel prices go down for the farmers and the truckers that brought the goods to the stores, to the fuel stations, etc.
Yeah. Where's this all going?
Them guys are still getting burned. How come, Peter?
Oh.
How come the Detroit companies, diesel companies, not even Detroit, could be Atlanta, Mississippi, we are going a long way, and we're getting burned because of the diesel prices have not subsided beyond the regular unloading.
You're
driving a truck.
Yeah, the diesel has not come down. I don't understand it. It's all this refinery stuff. I got to take one more call, and then we're out of here. So thank you very much. Let's get our next caller.
So if those prices come
down. I'm getting really sick of guys named Todd.
Are we ending on this note, Peter? Are we really?
Hey, yeah, it's Todd from Southgate.
What's up, Todd?
Hello, how's it going, guys?
Yeah.
Good.
I got a question for you, Peter.
Yeah.
Don't you think it is just horrible that you have a flat screen TV and cable when there's a guy who could be sleeping on a park bench in Detroit right now?
No, listen, Peter's not responsible for that.
I'm just saying. I mean, at least Peter, anyway, was complaining about the top 1% having too much money, blah, blah, blah.
Well, we are so far from the top 1%.
Well, no, I know, I'm just saying, but I think there's a huge difference between people like yourselves and me and whoever else,
right,
and versus the guy who's sleeping on a park bench. And, you know, so where exactly do you draw the line? I want to know where you draw the line to there being the person in the top 1% who has to give up a ton of his money to give to poor people versus you who maybe can buy a flat screen TV and then maybe not worry about the person on the bench in Detroit at the moment.
Well, you know, charity, for instance, is vertical. That is to say that people above, at a certain level, give money, whatever, to people below. I haven't told this story in years, but somebody I know lives in West Bloomfield, very wealthy, saw these people during a Detroit winter. There was a little bit on them, how they were outside, sleeping outside. Mm-hmm. And this friend of ours' wife went out and bought about 10 blankets and brought them downtown. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, she was so moved by what these people were suffering. Well, then, you know, she went home to her, you know, the expensive
down comforter.
Yeah, in her West Bloomfield house. So it's not so much whether I have a flat-screen TV or Warren Buffett has $65 billion. It's how is wealth utilized in this country. Well, we're squabbling over whether to give the auto companies an $18 billion bridge loan and all the jobs that depend on it and the desire on the part of these Republicans to cut back wages for auto workers. When somebody like Warren Buffett or the Waltons or somebody like that, they could write a check. Hey, auto companies, you need this? Here it is. All right, got to go, Todd. Thank you.
And we mean the Walmart Waltons, not Joe Bob and Jimmy
yeah,
Sue.
Right. All right, Jalene. Oh, you know what? We haven't said one. This was not even an issue.
What's that?
We, you know, all that stuff get into, you know, whether Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays or whatever. But there are a lot of holidays out there, and some of us who celebrate the solstice, which was yesterday, Sunday.
Yes.
So whatever you celebrate or nothing, have a great Great go at it. Great celebration. Celebrate something. Roger, thanks for answering those phones. And we will be back next week. But stay tuned. Got a great interview coming up.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's Deals and Deals and get stuff for half price. Or hear 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Websites
worldwide.
101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
Attention. Celtrixa is currently seeking participants with stretch marks. If you have stretch marks due to weight gain, pregnancy, even bodybuilding, you are eligible to try Celtrixa free. Celtrixa was introduced to improve skin and has now been shown to dramatically reduce the size and depth of stretch marks on any area of the body. It effectively fades even very dark stretch marks as it repairs the damaged skin. To participate in the Celtrixa trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-962-1055. Stretch marks can mar and damage the skin, making the body look unattractive. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen stretch marks diminish and fade, watched as ugly zipper-like marks began to repair themselves. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your stretch marks, you are eligible to participate and experience a free trial of Celtrixa. For your free trial, call this number today. 1-800-962-1055. 1-800-962-1055. 1-800-962-1055.
Between the millions of millionaires in this country and you? Simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires. So they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now. 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
Is your credit score holding you back? Are you paying more for everything just because you don't have perfect credit? Well, it's not your fault. Credit card companies are doing everything they can to keep you in debt and never let you escape. But I've got a system that can fix your credit score once and for all. And I'm going to send you a free tape showing you the power of my proven system today.
My credit score is now 758. My wife and I are shouting for joy right now.
Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My system doesn't just fix your credit score, it will permanently rebuild your credit status so it can never come back to haunt you again. It works no matter how bad your credit is or how much debt you have.
Our credit score was in the low 600s and now we're at 780.
You can wipe the slate clean once and for all. Call right now and I'll rush you my free tape. For your free tape, call 1-800-337-1713. That's 1-800-337-1713. 1-800-337-1713.
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, we're into the season where we start singing about peace on earth and all that good stuff, and it doesn't really make it happen. We all have a desire for peace. None of us want to be visited by the conflicts that we see raging all across the world. And sometimes we wonder, particularly when we're looking from afar, what's at stake in Congo, or what's happening in Sri Lanka? Why are Pakistan and India have the potential for fighting with the weapons that they have? Where do all these weapons come from? Well, there's a brand new report out from the group New America Foundation, and it's authored by Frieda Berrigan and also William D. Hartung. Bill Hartung, as you know, has been a guest any number of times on the Peter Werby Show, and so I thought we would welcome Frieda Berrigan, who's a senior program associate of the Arms and Security Initiative of the New America Foundation. She served for 8 years as the deputy director and senior research associate at the Arms Trade Resource Center at the World Policy. It's a pleasure to welcome Frieda Berrigan. She's at her office in New York City. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter.
Well, Frieda Berrigan, you just released this about a week ago or so, and it was on the occasion of the International Human Rights Day. Did you pick that day for a particular reason?
You know, we did. December 10th is International Human Rights Day, and actually December 10th, 2008, marked the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the First Lady at the time, Eleanor Roosevelt, played a large role in getting that document together and drafting it, and then having it be accepted by all of the major countries in the world. And there were a lot of celebrations of the International Declaration of Human Rights on that day and in that window there. And we felt like it was a good opportunity to highlight the role played by the United States 60 years ago in enshrining and defining and codifying what are human rights, and then to look at where we are today when the United States is actively arming and supporting militarily many of the nations that are responsible for the most egregious and outrageous abuses of human rights. And while we pay a lot of lip service to human rights and to their importance, those sentiments are not carried out, are not supported by our weapons sales policy. So it seemed like a good opportunity to talk about what is essentially the biggest export that the United States has right now, which is our weapons and our military aid.
I want to get into the details of that. Let's stick just for a second or so on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and its 60th anniversary on December 10th, 2008. I would suspect if there's 1% of the audience that actually knows much about those, that declaration, I would be surprised. And I heard someone read them the other night on a radio show, and there's like 30 or some place close to that, about what every one of us on the planet deserves. And I was thinking, boy, if these were in practice, we'd live in a peaceful, almost utopian world, but they certainly seem to not be practiced very much in hardly any country.
No, I mean, there are 30 articles in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and Article 1 essentially sums it all up. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood, and I would add, and sisterhood. If that was the standard by which we conducted our international affairs, the world would be a very, very different place.
I did notice today, in terms of your gender correction, to make it more universal, that even throughout it they always use the male gender. They talk about he has the right and all that, but that was 60 years ago. And
that was 60 years ago.
Well, let's talk about your report. It's called U.S. Weapons at War 2008, Beyond the Bush Legacy, and it was released on December 10th, International Human Rights Day. And what do we learn from it? What did you and your co-author Bill Hartung learn over the course of the year that we should know?
Well, there are a number of important findings, and to start off, basically, and this is sort of the least surprising of all the findings, is that the United States is the world's top arms supplying nation. In 2007, we made $32 billion worth of weapons sales agreements with the governments and the militaries of foreign countries. The last time we looked at this issue was in 2005, and we released a report called Weapons of War 2005. That $32 billion for 2007 is a threefold increase over 2005. So when we talk about the Bush legacy, it is a legacy of sharp increases in the number of weapons sold and the value of those weapons and the countries to which we're selling weapons. One of the shocking findings, at least for me, in putting together this report, was how pervasive U.S. weapons are. During 2006 and 2007, the United States provided weapons and military training to over 174 states and territories. In 2001, not to drown your listeners in numbers, but in 2001, we gave weapons and military training to 123 states. So that's a sharp increase. And you know, there are 193 nations, I think, that are part of the United Nations, and then only a couple territories that are outside of the UN, mostly because they're so small. So for U.S. weapons and military training, military assistance to be present in 174 nations is huge. It basically means there are only a few corners of the globe that are outside of our influence.
Well, I suppose the argument could be made that this is not a bad thing. It actually is part of our industrial base. In fact, that's, as you said, that gets to be what's left of the American industrial base. So it provides jobs at home, and militaries, every country has them. Every country wants to have as strong a military as possible, and it would be used for within official states, some of which, of course, as you said, carry out egregious human rights violations. Others are allies of ours, and everybody should have a strong military. We want a strong military. Why shouldn't everyone else?
Well, I think that question, you know, goes to the heart of our report and is why we didn't just write about how many countries have weapons, but how those weapons are used and the policies that those weapon sales support. Sure, every country wants a strong military, but when the United States is selling billions of dollars worth of weapons to Pakistan, India also wants those $1 billion worth of weapons, and because those two countries have fought three wars over the past 60 years, and now with the most recent terrorist attack in India and Mumbai, carried out by militants who are supported by the Pakistani intelligence services, tensions are once again super hot along that border. Both of those countries armed with U.S. weapons, both countries armed to the teeth. And so then the question has to be asked, is the defense industrial base in this country, which does provide jobs, but not nearly as many jobs as are provided when we invest seriously and significantly and over a long term in other aspects of our infrastructure and other aspects of our industrial base.
Mm-hmm, but this is really...
Is that worth it?
Yeah, it's really the military-industrial complex. I mean, we hear that phrase a lot, but when you start looking at that and try to get some precision as to the nature and quality of it, that's what it's all about, right?
That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
That's
well, let's talk about some of the where the money goes. We hear a lot about U.S. foreign aid, and we think about the United States feeding poor people in other countries, bringing health benefits to little children in Asia or Africa. Yet, when this so-called aid, much of it is military, isn't it?
The majority of it is actually military aid. The United States gives billions of dollars in security assistance on an annual basis, and one of the other legacies of the Bush administration, which is now on its way out, is that we have seen that security assistance funding essentially double from the beginning of Bush's first term in office in 2001 to today. We can think about $6 to $8 billion being spent in 2001, 2002, compared to about $14 to $15 billion in 2007, 2008. And that security assistance goes to militaries all over the world, and in many, many cases, dwarfs the humanitarian aid that's coming through the State Department or even through unofficial channels through non-governmental organizations. Cumulatively, we're talking about $110 billion in security assistance throughout the Bush administration. So there's a huge volume there. And it's not going to the countries who are trying to build up modest and comprehensive true defenses for themselves, but it's going mostly to countries that are acting in an aggressive way.
Well, let me ask, just to interrupt you just a second, because one of the things I've always been mystified about is when there is, say, when you list in your report U.S. weapons at war 2008 beyond the Bush legacy, you talk about transfers of weapons and how they fuel war in active conflict, areas of active conflict. So Pakistan gets $3.7 billion. Is this a grant? I mean, do we just ship them $3.7 billion and then they buy weapons from us? Is that how it works? Or
essentially, I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It goes through a number of channels. It doesn't come all at once. It's allocated over the course of a year in many cases. Israel is the only country that gets a lump sum all at once. as a close ally, or as the closest ally. But yeah, essentially, that money is paid out to Pakistan over the course of the year. Well, first it's promised and then it's paid out incrementally. And Pakistan, as a major non-NATO ally of the United States, given that distinction, I think in 2002 by President Bush, Pakistan is able to do a lot of different things with that money. It's able to buy uniforms and military material for its security forces, most of which it buys from the United States. It's able to buy large weaponry from the United States. And then, as a major non-NATO ally, it's also eligible for a program which we actually didn't talk a lot about in our report, but which is really important for listeners to understand. There's a program called the Excess Defense Articles Program, and basically, it's a yard sale for U.S. military hardware, for the things that have been used by our Army and Marines and Navy and Air Force, that are old or worn out or have been replaced by a newer model but are still functional and useful. And we give those weapons away to allied militaries all the time, usually for dimes on the dollar. So Pakistan is now eligible for that as well.
Hmm.
But Pakistan was the largest recipient. Turkey was right behind. And
why Turkey? I don't understand this on this list. Five nations: Pakistan, Turkey, Israel, Iraq, and Colombia. But why Turkey? $3 billion to Turkey of our tax dollars? I don't get that. What's the official reasoning for that?
Sure. Turkey is becoming a member of NATO. It's in the middle of modernizing its military forces. And part of being a member of NATO is demonstrating interoperability with the militaries and the hardware used by the militaries of NATO. So Turkey is trying to meet all of those requirements, and that's an expensive proposition.
Hmm.
And going just back to the military-industrial complex, that's one of the reasons that Lockheed Martin, the largest defense contractor here in this country, and other major defense contractors were so actively pushing for the expansion of NATO at the end of the Cold War, all the way through the 90s. Vice President from Lockheed Martin was sort of on sabbatical on this personal passion, this crusade to open up NATO to the Eastern Bloc, former Eastern Bloc states, and former members of the Soviet Union. And, all the language was about human rights and democracy and bringing these countries into the first world. But there was also this ulterior motive.
It's all about the arms market.
Right.
Yeah.
Poland's going to buy F-16 fighter planes eventually. So.
Well, we have agreed to upgrade. We, and I use that advisedly, you and me and everyone listening with our tax dollars, have agreed to upgrade the Polish military in return for allowing this U.S. anti-missile system on their territory. That's sweet. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Frieda Berrigan. She's a senior program associate of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. You can go to newamerica.net and you can see the entire report. It'll also be on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Now, this is, and maybe we need to explain this a little, this is essentially military Keynesianism, that policy where the wealth we produce is in part taken by the government and then redistributed. But this is going out to, instead of like roads and schools and the infrastructure, infrastructure of the U.S., it goes to these countries. We give it, you and I give it to these countries, and then they buy back from this sector, this industrial sector, which really doesn't give us much bang for our buck. You mentioned that a little, Frieda Berrigan, but maybe expand on that. If you had, let me see, what was it, $32 billion spent on foreign military sales in 2007. If that would have been invested in the U.S., what would have been the difference? I don't know if you go into that in your report.
Well, it's not really in the report per se, but it's but you can extrapolate from it very easily. I mean, you think about something like the Apollo project, which is this network of green energy organizations and think tanks and research entities that are wanting the United States to be energy independent and be reliant on solar and green energy and all of that instead of on oil that we import from other countries. And they're talking about a need for $300 billion worth of investment in these sorts of technologies to really make that a reality. And $300 billion is a lot of money, right? But over 10 years that invested here in the United States, the ripple effects of that investment are profound. We talk about infrastructure. The American Civil Society of Engineers does this, or American Society of Civil Engineers does this report card on the American infrastructure every couple of years. And the most recent report card gives a D or C grade to many aspects of American infrastructure. And anybody who rides on roads in any city in this country knows the state of our infrastructure, right? And they talk about $1.4 trillion worth of investment needed in order to bring every aspect of the U.S. infrastructure, roads, airports, the water systems, Amtrak and other rail systems, to bring that up to a B or even an A grade. And that's jobs. That's good jobs.
Sure.
For many, many people. The jobs argument, when you look at the defense industry, doesn't pan out, right? There's, those products that are manufactured are shipped abroad. And so there's very little opportunity for the dollar to travel throughout the U.S. economy.
Right. You don't get much, as I think I said earlier, you don't get much bang for your buck, or you get a lot more bang for your buck if it's involved in supporting our civilian infrastructure. Now, it does provide some jobs, and I know, and I meant to bring this. There was a New York Times article a couple of days ago about this essentially Cold War fighter pilot, when we were going to be up in the air, fending off the MiGs from the Soviet Union, but that everyone involved say you can't cancel this weapons project because it has so many jobs in Georgia and in California and what have you. So it's almost this military-industrial complex has almost, I'll take back almost, has made itself an absolute permanent part of the system. I mean, it is the military-industrial complex, and that defines in many ways a great portion of the U.S. economy. This is a difficult nut to crack.
It is a difficult nut to crack, and it's one of those very political issues because Lockheed Martin, which is the manufacturer of this fighter plane, the F-22 fighter plane, has it does employ people in the manufacturing of this aircraft, but they have very carefully put facilities for this the manufacturing of this aircraft. They have put facilities in just about every congressional district throughout this country, and so it's not like the auto industry, which has impact across the country, but is really concentrated in the Detroit area, or was concentrated in the Detroit area. They have put facilities all over the country. So there is a constituency in every congressional district just about that's ready to make an argument around jobs for this fighter plane. So all the arguments about how, this plane was designed for a Soviet plane that was never built. There's no country in the world that rivals the F-14 and the F-16 and the F-18 fighter plane that we already have. There's no need for this. We certainly don't need to spend $9 billion in 2009 to make more of these planes. All of those arguments have to stand up against 30 or 40 or 100 jobs in every single congressional district, and then a concentration of jobs in key districts connected to key members of Congress who really are have their finger on the lever of this issue. So,
well, can we expect Barack Obama to do anything different given this institutionalization of the military-industrial complex?
Well, Peter, that's a $600 billion question, right? That's what our military budget is shaping up to be for 2009.
We could defend ourselves probably with maybe a quarter of that.
Well, yeah. I mean, that figure represents what the next 47 nations combined spend on their militaries on an annual basis. That's 40%, 48% of what the entire world spends. So are we safe and secure as a nation spending that much money? And will we become more safe and secure as a nation if we spend more?
Well, guys with box cutters can do us in. So all of that technology and those almost $1 trillion military budget, when you figure everything in, isn't making us safer.
Right. So, but can Obama bring together a broad enough of a political constituency to begin to make those arguments? And Democrats have had a hard time with this. Clinton had a very difficult time taking on the military as someone who hadn't served in the military and someone who is a Democrat. And Obama coming in the middle of this very, very serious economic crisis that we're in, and every industrial sector just about looking for some sort of handout from Washington, and then the very real needs that are in every community that aren't being met right now, and the question coming up again and again, where's the money going to come from? And even as we've approached this economic recession in the years and months, as things have gotten tighter and tighter, the military budget has continued to increase, and the amount of foreign aid that we give to militaries of other countries has also continued to increase.
Now, I think if you took a poll here in the Detroit area and said, well, would you prefer that all of this money go to a bridge loan for the auto industry and rebuilding the infrastructure of the United States, or send it over to Pakistan and Turkey, Israel, Iraq, and Colombia? I don't think there'd be much of a debate. There's lots more on this subject, and you can go to newamerica.net, and it has the entire report of U.S. Weapons at War 2008, Beyond the Bush Legacy. My guest has been Frieda Berrigan from the New America Foundation. She's the co-author of the study. And I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Hey, really good to speak with you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. All right, $9 million.
All of you who have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIM. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
In national news, the New York Mint is releasing to the public a limited number of $100 Union Silver coins. At the end of this broadcast, we'll provide a toll-free number you can call to receive free information and a free DVD.
Sketches of the coin were recently discovered deep in the vaults of the Smithsonian. The $100 union was proposed by George T. Morgan, who also designed the Morgan Silver Dollar. It was to be the largest coin ever in size and denomination, and it weighs in at a hefty 1.5 ounces. In a startling announcement, the New York Mint plans to release a limited quantity of $100 union silver coins to the public. The silver $100 union proofs are available on a first-come, first-served basis by calling 1-800-957-5473. Please dial carefully. To receive the free collector's DVD containing the full story on this and many other coins, the number is 1-800-957-5473. That's 1-800-957-5473.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-441-6151. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-441-6151. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-441-6151. That's 1-800-441-6151.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I can't begin to count how many times we've talked about the war in Iraq and its occupation over the last, what is it now, 7, going on 8 years. And I look for ways that we can continue having this in our consciousness because people are still dying, lives are still being disrupted, refugees are still being created, infrastructures are being destroyed, suicide bombers continue. So even though with what we're facing economically, the war, although in its most ferocious stages, has tamped down considerably, it still continues. So this is a book by an author that approaches this from, I think you will agree when we begin our conversation, that is extraordinarily unique. Who I'm going to be interviewing is Iraqi-born artist Wafa Bilal, and he is right now a professor, an assistant professor at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, and he has exhibited his artwork worldwide, including Baghdad, but also the Netherlands, Thailand, Croatia, as well as the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago, the Milwaukee Art Museum, and considerable number of other places as well. His book is called Shoot in Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun, and it's written with Carrie Leiterson. And we welcome Wafa Bilal from his home in New York City. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter. It is really a pleasure to be on your show.
Now, this is such an extraordinary story, and rather than getting right into what the title refers to, Shoot in Iraqi, let's just get a little of your personal history, because you were born in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and you've been here. You've come to the United States in 1992. You're an American citizen, so you've been here a very long time. But tell us some of your childhood and where you were raised and the circumstances of how you got to the United States.
I was born in the holy city of Najaf. That's a holy Shia center for the entire world, and it's about 80 kilometers south of Baghdad, and in the 1966. And that was just a few years before the Ba'ath Revolution. And when I grew up under the regime of Saddam Hussein. Basically, one of the just kids who idolized the Ba'ath Party and didn't see the danger that is behind Saddam and his regime.
Mm-hmm. Let me just interrupt to tell people that that you're talking about the Ba'ath Party, B-A-A-T-H, and it was Saddam Hussein's party.
Yes.
And it was a totalitarian party in that it totalized all political thought and a lot of cultural thought, right?
Very much so, and I may add also that the regime, Saddam's regime and the Ba'ath Party were brought to Iraq by the CIA in the early 60s, 60s. And it continued, the CIN, the United States, continued to support the regime until it toppled in 2003. But going back to the childhood, I very much idolized the regime, idolized Saddam, and idolized the party as well. But growing up and see how the regime of Saddam is personally dismantle any democratic infrastructure and it become a totalitarian regime that it only serve one man, and any person that opposed him will be eliminated, and sometimes in a brutal way and graphic way by tying him to the nearest pole and shoot him.
Hmm.
So I early on...
Did you actually see any of that? Were you aware personally of how brutal and oppressive Saddam Hussein was?
As a kid, no. I mean, kid growing up, Saddam's tried to... replace the allegiance of the family, of the tribe, to the allegiance to the state. And he was very successful. As kids, he take us kids and open art centers, a youth center, supply us with anything. And that was part of the plan, is to gain our trust. And in fact, it got to the point when kids start reporting on their dads and family members the family members being against the state. And then in the 80s, things start changing. Before the 80s, before 1880 war with Iran, Saddam had very good control over Iraq. And in the 1980, Saddam decided to attack Iran and topple the regime of Khomeini, which is just a very young regime, took over Iran in the revolution in 1997. And from that point, we start seeing bodies arise to Najaf and the holy city. A lot of Shiite are buried in Najaf. And we saw the regime becoming more and more brutal in his effort to win the war and effort to send the young Iraqis to the front line. Then the money started rolling from the art centers, and we start opening our mind to how, to the direction that Saddam was taking the country, and how families are losing just members on a daily basis.
Wasn't there about, I think, a million soldiers died during the Iran-Iraq war of the 1980s? I mean, it's just a slaughter that the United States has never even faced.
Very true. I mean, 1 million people on both sides, on the Iraqi side and on the Iranian side. And imagine the country was about 13 million people at the time. Imagine losing 1 million people over the period of 8 years, from 1980 to 88.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a very big impact on Iraqi and devastated the Iraqis, but also brought the wars of the regime. And he starts capturing people on the street and sending them to the front line. And if people are opposed to that, go on to the front line, they will be captured and executed, sometime publicly.
Did you have family members that were involved in the fighting?
In the front line, I had my brother for a long period of time. And I have one of my cousins that was executed for being accused of belonging to another party. And that was the turning point for me when I saw how my cousin was just unjustifiably executed. I very much woke up and I start just opposing to the regime.
Let me reintroduce you as well. My guest is Wafaa Bilal. He is an Iraqi-American. He's been here since 1992. He teaches art. and New York City, and his book published by City Lights is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Gun, and we'll get to the extraordinary part that art plays in this story in just a little while. Wafa, are you from a Shiite background?
My family, yeah. I am a Shiite. I grew up in the holy city of Najaf and most of the south of Iraq and big part of Baghdad are Shiite. So Saddam's, in particular, oppressed the Shiite in Iraq because he's from a Sunni background and Iran is mostly Shiite. So he was from the very beginning fighting the Shiite, and the Shiite never submit to his rule. And they always fought him politically and sometimes military within inside Iraq. But he was very afraid of the alliance of the Shiite of Iran and Shiite of Iraq. And that was part of why he attacked Iran right away after Khomeini took over.
Yeah, in 1979 when Khomeini took over,
exactly.
And then the war began in 1980. You talk in your book, Shoot an Iraqi, that you were forced to flee in the chaotic aftermath of the first Gulf War. What were the circumstances that drove you out of the country?
Yeah, well, this bring back to us to my days in college. And what happened is when I finished high school, I applied to art school, and that was one of my dreams as a kid to finish, to go to art school, to the Academy of Baghdad. And when I applied, I was rejected because of the executed cousin, and then I was sent to study geology and geography at the University of Baghdad. Through the years, about 5 years at the university, I produced an art show that was critical of the regime in a direct way or indirect way. And as a consequence, sometimes the show will be closed permanently. Sometimes the show will be confiscated. And every time I have a show, I will be dragged to the security office at the University of Baghdad. And in 1990, when the regime invaded Kuwait, I was in the last year of college at the University of Baghdad, and the regime come and to ask us to volunteer to go to war, and I was one of the people who are publicly refused to do such a thing, and I know my days were numbered at that time, and I was on the run. So I left Baghdad to Najaf, and from Najaf, when I got there, the war started. The United States started bombing, and the Allies started bombing to free Kuwait, and that lasted about 40 days or so. But right after that, the uprising took place in Iraq against the Saddam regime.
This was in the south, where the Shiites, they initially were pretty much encouraged to do so.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, by George Bush the First.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And when he basically he gave a televised speech to the entire Iraqi nation and asking them to rebel against Saddam, and the United States will help them. And in fact, it was on the contrary. We were very surprised to see George Bush the senior helping Saddam to quell the uprising instead of helping people. So I basically was cornered because Saddam starts, after the uprising and people captured the city, Saddam start moving from Baghdad to all the way to Basra to capture the cities back, and he brutally bombed them with every weapon he can use under the watch of United States. And I was moving ahead of the military one city by one until I got to Kuwait. And in Kuwait, I crossed the border against the will of Kuwaitis, and I was arrested. But luckily, I was let out and stayed on the border for another 40 days when later we were under the protection of United States Army, and later we were transferred to refugee camps in Saudi Arabia, one in Spain, 2 years there.
And then you, in fact, I'm finding this fascinating because we usually we just look at the bigger picture, and when we hear how the war there affected people directly, yeah. It takes on a different character to it. The book is Shoot an Iraqi: Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun. My guest is Wafa Bilal. And also writing the book along with him, Carrie Leiterson. Let's do this because I want to hear more of this, but I also want to get people up to the subtitle of Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Gun. Now, you came here in 1992. You became an American citizen, an artist whose works have been shown all over the world. And then suddenly, you realize that in Iraq, during the 90s, there's this blockade by the United States that's causing all sorts of deaths there of Iraqi people. And then by 2002, there's the war again. The shadows of war return. And yet your family was all in Iraq, right?
Very much so. I mean, I left Iraq. I was running and... the only other person, my brother, who in fact lives in Detroit right now. But the entire family left in Iraq, and one thing many people didn't know, that after the war ended in 1991, there was an embargo, a blockade against Iraq that lasted almost 10 years. And maybe more 10 years, and other consequences, 1.5 million Iraqi lost their lives because of that, and mostly kids and older. And and the family, my immediate family were impacted very strong, and we lost my grandfather, my grandmother, due to very simple thing. Because they cannot afford buying simple medication. And then we lost one thing that is very important. Just our childhood memories revolve around the place we grew up, our grandfather's home. And the family were forced to sell it for nothing just so they could survive for a few months.
So you are living in the safety and comfort of the United States, and here your relatives back in the old country, as we used to call it, are suffering this great travail. What were your emotions at this period?
The emotion was very high, and I think being an artist helped me a lot to deal with this duality, just because being here, and you see there is just a great injustice being done to the Iraqi people. In fact, the embargo never affected Saddam because it made him even stronger. And in fact, some of Bush's administration, like Dick Cheney, was dealing with him directly buying the oil, or indirectly sometimes. So what I did through the 90s, I focused my effort in exposing how the embargo hurting the Iraqi people by building shows, by going on the road for speaking tours, just to, one, to raise awareness, and I saw that is a great deal since I'm here in the United States. If anything could change, it has to come from the people. And that's why I have so much faith in the people to change the status quo. Mm-hmm. And instead of being against the people of the United States, I saw them as a victim as well of this political machine of the government. And I very much start connecting with people through my art show. I start connecting to people by talking to them, going from one state to another to raise awareness of the embargo. And then the war, or just the drums of a new war against Iraq, we start hearing in 2002 and early 2003, and I couldn't even believe it. We're going to go to another war with Iraq.
And then it occurred, and civilians are being killed, and your own brother was killed in Iraq by a U.S. bomb, and not by a human being, but by an unmanned predator drone. Tell us what you discovered after this terrible event occurred, that about what you saw about
yeah.
the... Yeah.
Well, in 2003, I was one of the few Iraqis who opposed the war, Iraqis in the United States opposing the war, because what I saw just the people going to be affected, not Saddam's regime, and I opposed it from the very beginning, and I know there are going to be great losses by turning Iraq to a war zone. So in 2004, unfortunately, I received the news that is, one of my brothers was killed in Iraq, and at the beginning, I didn't get the details from the family how he was killed, but then I learned he was on the street when a drone plane scoped the city, and then an air-to-surface missile come to where he was standing in a checkpoint and killed him instantly.
And this, you watched a TV interview and found out that a young U.S. soldier whose job it was to launch missiles into Iraq from a computer in Colorado had been the one that had pushed the button. And
very much so. So from 2004, and I have to say 2 months later, we lost my father because he was grieving, and he couldn't handle the shock of losing his son all of a sudden. So we lost him 2 months later. But I continue to think how I could connect these two zones together, the comfortable zone here, which I live in, and there the war zone, the conflict zone.
So we get actually now to the title of your book, which we've been holding people in suspense now for almost 20 minutes. We
yes.
just have a few minutes left, so we should probably go directly to that. The book is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun, Wafa Bilal and Carrie Leiterson. And you did essentially an art installation, Domestic Tension.
Yes.
And that's where the title Shoot an Iraqi. Tell us
exactly,
about that.
Exactly. So in 2007, I was watching the news when I saw an interview with a soldier that's directing drone planes and dropping missiles on Iraq, and when she was asked by the reporter if she had any remorse on people's lives, she said, no, I trust the order of my superiors. And it really shocked me how we become disconnected even by targeting other people in other countries. And that's when the idea came, and the idea was I wanted to demonstrate how we are disconnected. So what I did, I moved my living space to a gallery space. I built a robot that shoot paintball at me, and I stayed in the gallery for 30 days. During that 30 days, I had people from 136 countries shooting at me, with 80 million hits on the website and 65,000 times I was shot at. I never left the gallery space, and during that time, I was constantly talking to people on a chat room, which is where they could see me and talk to me 24 hours, 7 days a week for 30 days.
Let me just summarize this. So you set up an installation, essentially, that people, by just a mouse click, could shoot you with a paintball. You were shot 60,000 times. Your site had millions of hits to it. And what did you think about the fact? Did it hurt when you got hit by a paintball?
It does. I mean, anybody who play paintball, it just really hurt. And these guns are designed to shoot from 200 feet, and the gun was about 20 feet from me. It hurt a lot, but also I learned great deals about myself, about my people, and how to deal with the losses as well. I deny I lost my brother, I lost my father, until I was emotionally and physically exhausted in the project, and I finally admit the losses. But I think the most thing that fascinates me is just how the platform become a place for people to express their thoughts, people to connect to each other, people to talk about issues like war, and many of us here in the comfortable zone are reluctant to talk about it. And all of a sudden, you see the side that you could shoot somebody and all the traffic coming in. But then you encounter this is not just a playful game. This is really human being is being shot at.
Yeah, were you shocked that you were shot at so many times with the paintballs?
Yes.
Yeah, and I see from your book, Shoot an Iraqi, that some of the what was said in the chat room was also pretty shocking, pretty racist,
very
pretty
brutal,
mean.
Very I mean, it's very brutal, and I think that's the nature of being disconnected. It's just because we part of it is we demonize others because we are unaware of that culture. And I think the website demonstrated, the chat room demonstrated that very well by bringing the brutality in people to express themselves. And there are just brutal moments, but there are also wonderful moments happen there when a group of people decide to establish the virtual human shield, and for many days they start defending me by taking the gun and aiming it to the left side, so preventing other people from shooting directly at me.
Oh, well, there is hope.
Of course, and I think that's what we have to believe in, because that's the only thing left to us, hope, and also we have to be determined to gain our freedom, not only freedom, but we have to be determined to ask for justice to other countries as well.
Well, you know, we're almost out of time completely, and I would leave you with the last word, Wafa Bilal. It looks like things are beginning to come to the end of this seemingly endless war, an occupation that the United States launched, all on the basis of lies, of course. Is there hope for Iraq, in your estimation?
Peter, there is hope for Iraq and hope for the United States, but I'm really now, after I left the pinball project, the domestic tension, I was faced with a post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's what my fear is. What happened when 150,000 soldiers gonna come back home? One, we have to be aware of their post-traumatic experience, but also we have to be aware that we never go to another war without knowing the fact, and we should never let any government drive us to dark places, and at the end we and the rest of the world gonna lose.
Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Wafa Bilal. You can go to his website and see much more of all of this. W-A-F-A-A is the first name, B-I-L-A-L.com. If you missed that, you can either go to City Lights, that's the publisher, citylights.com, or my website where I'll have a link, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. The book is Shoot an Iraqi, Art, Life, and Resistance Under the Sun. Wafa Bilal and Kerry Leiterson are the authors. Thank you so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G. Your new Apple iPhone 3G connects you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, we're going to get you in a room.
Log on and listen worldwide at WRIF.com. The Riff.
Does your furnace need repair, your house need cleaning, or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen? Big or small, whatever your home improvement need, now it's easy to find the right home pro for your project. Log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to pre-screen remodelers, maids, handymen, roofers, and many other home contractors. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic has a network of licensed and insured contractors in hundreds of home improvement categories. If you need a painter, electrician, plumber, or any other home service, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free. And it's the source to find neighbor-recommended contractors in your area. Now you can hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's quick, it's free, and there's no obligation. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
Your credit card debt is getting out of control. You're having trouble making the monthly minimums. Sound familiar? You have to do something, but what? Well, you don't have to file for bankruptcy. The mortgage brokers want you to put up your family home to pay off credit card debts. Problem is that more often than not, you find yourself using the credit cards again. Only this time, there's no equity left in your home, and you have a whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. We're Credit Card Relief. We help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. We're an attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free and the relief is real.
Call 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. 1-866-290-8282.
What if I told you that you could put up a brand new building and save up to half the cost and up to half the time as similar conventional construction? It probably sounds too good to be true. Well, just by picking up the phone, I can prove it to you. If you need retail, office, or warehouse space, or if your church or school wants to expand and save money, you need General Steel. Call today, and we'll prove to you that your new building can go up in about half the time, and you'll save up to half the cost.
Dial 1-800-220-4155.
We'll help you customize your building. You choose the size. You can even add the look of brick, stucco, or stone to achieve the look you want.
If you still think this sounds too good to be true, then pick up the phone and call. The information is free when you call 1-800-220-4155. Call General Steel and find out how you can put up a brand new building in about half the time and save up to half the cost of similar conventional construction. Call now, 1-800-220-4155. 1-800-220-4155.
Come on, boys. You can spend Christmas with us.
Giving you back to the rock. 101 WRIF.
Everything rocks.